And welcome to Film Bookcast, the official podcast of filmbook.com. My name is Mike Smith, and joining me, as always, is a man who reminds me today of a small Mexican chihuahua.
Mike DiCuccio.
How you doing today, Mike?
Good. Confused, but good.
that's perfect, because we're about to review Twin Peaks, and what better mode to be in than confusion?
Pretty much.
I mean, both of my references were to Twin Peaks that I just did. Hello from the new season, which I think you got.
Yeah.
Okay, and the other one is from the old series, which is something that Gordon Cole says to Cooper. Today you remind me of a small Mexican chihuahua.
Oh, man. So, Mike.
Yeah, so that is where we're at today.
Yep.
I'll be honest, been drinking a little bit.
Also the perfect state to be in to talk about this new season of Twin Peaks.
Exactly. So if you've never listened to a Film Bookcast before, first we start with some film news and then we move on into some discussions where Mike and I each discuss whatever piece of media we've been consuming lately. Today we're going to talk about Game of Thrones in that discussion, which we're pretty excited about. And then after that, we're going to move on into our feature review. This week we are diving deep into Twin Peaks The Return, the 18-hour epic that finally concluded 1 week ago as of this recording. Now, Mike, you just finished it yesterday, right?
Yeah. I was pretty far behind with this season, and I've watched between this weekend, I watched about 7 hours of the last Twin Peaks season. And I've finished the finale, the final episode, or the last two episodes, 17 and 18, last night.
Yeah, that is a lot to handle in a very short amount of time, I feel like. Like, I've been keeping up with Twin Peaks very easy. Like, I've been watching it pretty much as it airs throughout the summer, this entire summer. Like, it was appointment viewing for me on Sunday nights. It was this and Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wake up very early on Monday mornings for work, so I've just been exhausted this entire summer. But it was worth it, because Twin Peaks The Return, man. I mean, if anybody who has listened to this podcast will know, I'm kind of a big fan.
Yeah, we've noticed.
Of Twin Peaks. So we're going to talk about Twin Peaks a lot in a little bit. Right now, let's get into some film news.
Hi, it's time for...
What?
It's time for... It's time for...
Film news.
Hi, it's time for...
What?
It's time for... It's time for...
Film news. Film news.
All right, it's time for film news here on Film Bookcast, and we got a couple of quick things to get through before we get into some major news, but I wanted to throw this out there. A couple of superhero directors. The directors themselves aren't superheroes, but they are being attached to superhero movies.
Maybe it's their secret identities are directors of superhero movies. Ooh, we don't know.
You never know, Mike. You never know. So yeah. A couple of DC directors. First off, Patty Jenkins, who directed Wonder Woman, is officially attached to direct Wonder Woman 2. That was announced earlier today. And got a huge raise as part of it, too. Well-deserved.
Really? Yeah.
Definitely. I mean, she earned, I think, $1 million off of the original Wonder Woman.
What? He made like $800 billion or something. Like, what?
I know. She made about $1 million off of the first Wonder Woman. Now for Wonder Woman 2, I believe she's getting $9 million plus back end points. Back end is where the real money comes in. For a lot of these movies. So that's cool. Very, very good for Patty Jenkins. And then also Gavin O'Connor is now attached to direct Suicide Squad 2. And if you don't know Gavin O'Connor, he directed movies like Miracle with Kurt Russell, Warrior with Tom Hardy and Joel Edgerton, which Warrior is actually dope. Warrior is a great movie. Warrior is really good. That's the MMA movie with Tom Hardy.
Right.
It's really good. And he also directed The Accountant with Ben Affleck, which I did not see, but I know you saw, right?
I think we talked about that. Yeah.
Yeah. So refresh my memory. What was your thoughts on The Accountant?
Like kind of dumb, but kind of cool.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, then he sounds perfect for Suicide Squad 2.
I mean, I can't wait for the oddly inspirational version of Suicide Squad 2.
Yeah, that's true. Yes, I mean, Suicide Squad 2 is one of several movies WB has featuring the Joker that is in development right now.
I really hope Kurt Russell Will Smith just gives Kurt Russell's speech from Miracle in character as Deadshot? Deathstroke?
Dead something. Deadshot.
Yeah.
Almost definitely Deadshot. Man, you haven't even been drinking. I don't know what's...
I just don't remember Suicide Squad.
Which is totally fair. Yeah, so Gavin O'Connor, probably a pretty good I feel like he's exactly the kind of person I would want directing Suicide Squad 2. I don't want somebody who I really like attached to it.
Because yeah, I don't not want for any... Sorry.
I was going to say, I don't want them wasting their time on Suicide Squad 2, you know? Like, that's...
I don't want anyone with a unique vision being forced to make a Suicide Squad 2.
Yeah, exactly. Like, Gavin O'Connor, I think, can make some good movies. Like, I really like Warrior. I like Miracle. And so, you know, I'm interested. Like, I'm not over the moon to see a Suicide Squad 2. But, like, if I'm going to see it, like, Gavin O'Connor is probably the perfect name to make that happen.
Sure.
And, yeah, so there's that. And then one other superhero director, and this is the most exciting one. Drew Goddard is now attached to make X-Force.
Sorry. I just appreciate that you had a drunk hiccup in the middle of that sentence.
yeah, I did.
It's the best.
It did happen. Yeah, Drew Goddard. Who some of you may know as the director of Cabin in the Woods. He also wrote The Martian. He was originally attached to make the Daredevil TV series for Netflix, and he left that to make the Sinister Six movie for Sony, and that didn't happen. So now he's making X-Force. He's a pretty big Joss Whedon guy. He was he worked on Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Angel and all those shows. I'm a big fan of Drew Goddard, and I'm really excited to see his X-Force movie. And it is confirmed that this will definitely feature Deadpool and Cable as well. I'm assuming Deadpool. I'm assuming the movie's like centered around Deadpool in some way. Like I'm figuring Fox is like kind of configuring their X-Men universe to be to center around Deadpool at this point.
Yeah, it's the only thing making lots of dollars for them in terms of X-Men movies. Yeah. Well, besides Logan, I guess. But,
I mean, that was the last one, so...
Right. There's that.
That ended on a pretty final note for Logan right there.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I'm down for X-Force if it's just going to be silly, fun times.
Yeah. I think it's... I mean, from what I gather about X-Force, it's more of like the hyper-violent comic... The hyper-violent brother of the X-Men comics. And so you have Deadpool and Cable, and Deadpool's kind of the crazy character, but then you have a bunch of super serious characters surrounding him. So Deadpool's comedy kind of bounces off of their deadpan almost. But I think there's a lot of potential here. Like, you can bring in X-23 from Logan and have her do a lot of cool shit. And, you know, I think there's a potential for a lot of really cool stuff with this X-Force movie. And Drew Goddard is really good with ensembles, so I'm excited to see where that goes. But we'll report on that more as news comes out. Let's move on into some more news, and this is really exciting. Now, Mike, we are both fans of True Detective.
Correct.
You more so than I think, at this point.
I was gonna say I haven't rewatched season two, but I don't think I ever will.
That's the thing. I remember I really loved season one when it aired, and I really I don't feel like I disliked season two as it aired, but I definitely didn't like it. You know, it's
right.
It kind of just it existed, and I've never rewatched either season of the show. But now True Detective season three is officially happening for HBO. Nick Pizzolatto is back and writing every episode, and now he's co-directing every episode. But the co-director that the other director of those episodes that he has with him, Jeremy Saulnier.
Boom.
He was the director, of course, of Blue Ruin and Green Room, and this is huge, man.
Yeah.
This is crazy.
It's a big jump.
This is awesome. So I mean, part of what I love about True Detective season one, every episode is directed by Cary Fukunaga, and that season has such a distinct vision for what's going through there. And Jeremy Saulnier, I think, is in a similar position in his career as Cary Fukunaga was when True Detective season one came out. You know, he has like two or three movies that were all really well received, and now he's jumping into this TV show where he can really like let his style fly really interesting ways. And so I think that this is really cool.
Yeah, I am very excited to see what just horrifically graphic and casual violence he can come up with in True Detective season three.
Yeah, there is stuff like that I distinctly remember from Green Room that still makes me like wince. Like,
So
very excited about that. And of course, Mahershala Ali is starring in the show as well. And he just won an Oscar for Moonlight. He was the bad guy for half of Luke Cage. And Luke Cage got noticeably worse when he was gone from the show. So, you know, there's a lot of potential with True Detective season three here. So that's pretty exciting. Could be a huge rebound season for that show.
Hopefully, yeah. If we can get a lot less of the half-baked philosophical Vince Vaughn dialogue and just more good things.
And more of the half-baked philosophical Matthew McConaughey dialogue.
Yes. There's a difference, and one of them works and one of them doesn't.
Yes. Yeah. No, I totally agree. So, yeah. Very excited about True Detective Season 3, and let's move on to the next bit of news. And this concerns the Hellboy reboot that is coming out soon. So we talked about this, I think, a few episodes ago. There's going to be a reboot of Hellboy. I believe Neil Marshall is directing it with David Harbour as Hellboy. And Ed Skrein has been cast as a character in the movie. And I did not write the character's name down. That's my bad. But he's playing a character from the comics.
Very interesting choice on their part.
He's like one of those characters you've heard so much about from the Hellboy comics. but there was some controversy surrounding his casting because the character, as is portrayed in the comics, is an Asian character, and Ed Skrein is a white dude. And if you're not familiar with Ed Skrein, he's kind of like a lower tier, like he's not like an A-list actor, but he was on Game of Thrones briefly. He was the original Dario Naharis before that role was recast.
Right. Wasn't he the villain in Deadpool?
He was, yes. He was the villain in Deadpool. He was also the guy who took over the Transporter franchise from Jason Statham.
Yeah, so he's that guy.
Yeah, he's the guy who replaces people or is replaced.
The poor man's Jai Courtney.
The poor man. Man, that is a low bar.
I kind of feel bad about that one.
No, I think I feel like I have no opinion on Ed Skrein as an acting presence.
Fair.
Whereas Jai Courtney... I feel like I don't really have that much of an opinion of him either. He's just in a lot of really bad movies. But anyway, Ed Skrein was cast as this role in Hellboy, and he issued a statement and left the role after the whitewashing controversy came out. And it's actually really cool of him. It shouldn't be on him to make that call. Like, he's just an actor.
No.
He's just an actor taking a part. Like, when you're an actor, especially an actor like him, who's not like a super well known actor, you kind of take what you can get. And he's been in a couple of high profile things, but he hasn't really made a name for himself. I feel like this is the most notable thing he's done is leaving this role from the Hellboy movie. But it's also, I feel like, the first example of this, like, publicly happening, like an actor taking a role and then, leaving it once once a backlash came out of, a racism whitewashing controversy.
Yeah.
Like Scarlett Johansson didn't leave Ghost in the Shell or anything. And, stuff like that. Like, there's, one of the movies I'll talk about today also has like a bit of a whitewashing controversy surrounding it, Death Note.
Oh yeah.
And I don't know, how far, like the way that, that movie is, it's an American adaptation of it, like set in America. So it's kind of different. But at the same time, there is a a pall of whitewashing cast over that movie. and so, just big props to Ed Skrein for doing this. I think this is, really cool of him.
Yeah, definitely. It's a big, and like you said, it's a huge risk for him. This being in the Hellboy reboot would, I assume, if it's successful, be a giant career boost for him.
Yeah.
And he dropped out of it to support his principles and stuff, and that's really cool, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So, wanted to give a shout out to Ed Skrein. Sorry you got cut out of Game of Thrones, but, that's got to be a bummer. Like,
yeah.
You're on the biggest show of all time, and you get recast for a more handsome dude.
The struggle.
And that character isn't even on the show anymore. So it's
I think he only won one or two more seasons. He would have made it.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah. So that's the Ed Skrein news. And then we got to move on into the biggest news, Mike. This is the hugest news. And it's
Shrek 5, finally here.
Yeah, surprise release.
It's about time. It's about time.
DreamWorks surprise released Shrek 5.
It did a midnight release, unannounced.
It came onto all of our phones like the U2 album.
Yeah, exactly.
This is the biggest news because it's Star Wars news, and obviously Star Wars news is always the biggest news. And it's part of the revolving door of directors now in the Star Wars franchise.
Yep.
Star Wars Episode 9, which we haven't gotten to Episode 8 yet, but Episode 9... coming down the pike. Mm-hmm. And Colin Trevorrow was supposed to direct Episode 9, Mike, but no longer will Colin Trevorrow be making that movie. In further proof that Star Wars is a machine with no tolerance for disruption, Trevorrow is out, which is insane.
I have such I'm so interested to know why. If a person as a director as unique and visionary as Rian Johnson can get a Star Wars movie made?
Yeah.
How does someone as Colin Trevorrow, who made fucking Jurassic World, which is a slam in my book.
Yes. No,
can't get one made? Like, what?
Yeah, I mean, this. I'm guessing, like, Johnson's vision just must have aligned with Disney's in a way. Like
I guess.
What he wanted to do was also similar to what Disney wanted to do, and they were able to work together. And Rian Johnson always just seemed like a much more humble dude anyway, so, like, he might know when to back down or might be able to, you know, talk to the people and, like, be able to make things happen. Trevorrow has always seemed, like, aloof in certain ways. Like, the way he talks about Jurassic World, the way he talks about The Book of Henry, which is a movie that came out this year. A lot of people thought, like, when The Book of Henry came, that movie got savaged. Like, The Book of Henry, I don't know if you saw anything about that movie.
I've never even heard of it.
Really? Okay. So, The Book of Henry, I highly recommend, once we finish this podcast, watch the trailer for The Book of Henry, because it is insane. It's insane. I believe it's an original idea by Colin Trevorrow. It's a pretty low. It was like a kind of a smaller scale movie that he made, like, after Jurassic World came out, before he moved on to Star Wars.
Right.
And it stars Naomi Watts and Jacob Tremblay from Room. And it also actually has one of the kids from It. The main kid from It is in the movie. And it starts off as, like, this precocious, like, child genius movie, and then it becomes, like, this child abuse drama, and then it becomes a murder subplot. And that's just in the trailer, Mike.
That's just the arc of the trailer.
Yeah, that is just the arc. There's a lot more to unpack. I haven't actually seen the movie, but I've read many reviews.
Okay. Right.
I was kind of fascinated with this. This came out in June. And when the movie came out, a lot of critics were like, you know, this movie's getting, like, terrible reviews. And the movie came out right after Disney had fired Phil Lord and Chris Miller from the Han Solo movie. And so people were like, well, if Disney will fire Phil Lord and Chris Miller for God knows what, like, The Book of Henry is getting savaged. Like, they, like, Colin Trevorrow has to be on his way out. And people were like, nah, that's not going to happen. Like, Colin Trevorrow can play ball with Disney. He'll do whatever they want. It's, you know, whatever. And that does not seem to be the case. They fired Colin Trevorrow. And on the one hand, like, I don't like Colin Trevorrow. Like, it's, you know, I kind of liked his first movie, Safety Not Guaranteed. I thought that was a pretty fun.
Yeah.
It's a pretty fun, like, solid, like, a little indie movie. And Jurassic World, I had more fun with than most, or at least I had more fun with than you did. But it's still not, like, a particularly great movie. And The Book of Henry is supposed to be terrible. And so I was not looking forward to Star Wars Episode IX just because the caliber of filmmaker that Disney had been hiring up to that point was so good. I mean, you know, J.J. Abrams, Force Awakens, Gareth Edwards, Rogue One, Rian Johnson, Phil Lord, Chris Miller, Colin Trevorrow. Like, it just, it's like one of these things, not like the other. And he was going to close out this trilogy of Star Wars movies. Like, you know, I didn't want that. And so, on the one hand, I'm glad that Trevorrow is out. You know, on the other hand, it really troubles me that Disney just feels like they can just toss directors around cavalierly like this, you know?
I definitely agree that it's starting to feel real weird. But like you said, yes, thank God Trevorrow's gone. But I don't know. I don't know. I'm hopeful that they will find. Did they announce who's replacing the Han Solo movie? I don't remember.
The Han Solo movie is going to be Ron Howard.
Oh, that's right. Oh, man, what a twist.
Yes.
I forgot about that.
Now the story of a Star Wars movie that lost everything.
Yeah.
And the one director who had no choice but to keep them all together.
God damn it. I hope they come back with just a, like, crazy pick for somebody. I'm sure they're not gonna.
I mean, my guess, there's no word yet on who's gonna replace Colin Trevorrow, but there's a lot of wish lists going around. I think the most logical choice, and supposedly this is the front runner for Disney, it's Rian Johnson.
I hope so. Yeah.
Like that would make the most sense. I know he did a story treatment for Episode 9 when he got hired for Episode 8, and then Colin Trevorrow actually, like, wrote the actual script, but Rian Johnson kind of helped develop the story. I think he actually talked about recently, and he didn't give, like, a yes or no answer. Like, he kind of dodged the question a little bit. And, you know, he's just coming off with, like, this massive undertaking of doing a whole Star Wars movie with Episode 8. And it kind of feels like, you know, once you ask somebody if you're going to do another one, it's kind of like when Daniel Craig was asked if he was going to do another James Bond. Like, that's such a massive thing. And he's just like, no, I'd rather slip my wrists. Like, and of course he's going to say that right after he just finished, like, this exhausting process.
Yeah.
You know, but eventually Daniel Craig came back to James Bond. So,
yeah, I think that would be really cool, especially since Rian Johnson's one of my favorite directors. I would be all about that. And just to see his weirdness in a Star Wars movie twice would be the best thing ever.
Yeah, he's and it also seems like he's the only one who's had a positive experience working on a Star Wars movie. So he seems like a logical choice.
That's true.
I saw a picture the other day of somebody tweeted this picture did not age well, and it's a picture from Chris Miller's Instagram that's captioned four Star Wars directors hanging out together, and it's Chris Miller, Phil Lord, Gareth Edwards, and Colin Trevorrow. And it was taken a year ago, and it's man, how times have changed.
Yeah,
because even Gareth Edwards, he had a pretty shitty experience from Rogue One. He was filming and then he was fighting with Disney, and supposedly he was kind of edged out during reshoots and Tony Gilroy came in to replace him.
Right.
Even though that wasn't really totally publicized, that was the thing. And even J.J. Abrams didn't have a great experience on his movie. He fought with Kathleen Kennedy a lot. And I think that's mainly the thing. This is Kathleen Kennedy's franchise. And to an extent, I respect that. Kathleen Kennedy has made a lot of great movies and, I totally respect that, but there's no, she's hiring these really great directors,
right? And then ignoring them, it seems,
and then not letting them flourish. And then again, Colin Trevorrow, not a great director, so I'm
so kind of okay, but kind of nervous.
Yeah, still, the Phil Lord and Chris Miller thing still stings. That's the one that hurts. But at least Rian Johnson seems to have had a good time, and
So good for him. Yeah,
and from what I hear, Disney's really happy with Episode 8, and so that bodes really well for Episode 8. I feel like. I would love for them to hire Rian Johnson soon. I feel they have to hire somebody really soon if they want to make their release date, which for Episode 9, they want May 2019, which is without a director. I don't know if that's going to happen. It just feels like Rian Johnson's the logical choice, and it would be such a huge vote of confidence for Episode 8 if they hired him for Episode 9 before Episode 8 comes out. That would be huge.
Yeah, hopefully. We can only hope.
Yeah. I've also heard Ava DuVernay's name thrown around a lot. For Star Wars. And that's because A Wrinkle in Time opens up for Disney in March, and she directed that. And so the timing would work out, and that almost seems like it could be a dry run for a Star Wars thing. So
right.
That would work out well, and that would solve Star Wars' diversity problem behind the scenes.
I kind of was going to say that. I wonder if they're going to go for a female director or a person of color or something like that.
Yeah.
To replace for Episode 9, which, sure, that would be fucking awesome.
Yeah, very cool. Yeah, so Colin Trevorrow no longer directing Episode 9. Things that we thought we knew are no longer, Mike. It's crazy.
Oh, what a quaint preview for your Twin Peaks review.
Is it future or is it past, Mike?
We'll never know.
We will never know. I do got one last bit of film news, and once again, some sad news. Every film podcast, we have somebody who died that we really respect and love. This time around, it's Tobe Hooper, the iconic horror director of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, is kind of his legacy. That's one of the most iconic slasher films of all time. It kind of kickstarted the entire genre of slasher film in the 70s. I was saying to my friend the other day, I feel like there's four main slasher films from that era, and it's Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Halloween, Friday the 13th, and Nightmare on Elm Street. Those are the four that I think of. It's kind of the big four when you go to a metal show. It's Metallica, Anthrax, Megadeth, and whatever.
And Slayer or some shit.
I think it's Slayer, yeah. Those the big four slasher movies. It's them. And Texas Chainsaw is the first one. It kickstarted all of that. Texas Chainsaw is great. But he also directed one of my personal favorites. He sort of directed one of my personal favorites. There's a big controversy around this. But Poltergeist. And there's a big... there's always been this rumor he's credited as the director, but behind the scenes rumors say that Steven Spielberg was the actual director and Tobe Hooper was just there because Spielberg was the producer and Spielberg was going to direct it, but then he had to do E.T. instead. So it's a kind of a weird thing. And I feel like Poltergeist is one of my personal favorite horror movies, but it's such a perfect mixture of both of their sensibilities for Hooper and Spielberg. And I really love it for that. And it's such a good movie. I love Poltergeist to death. And he's got such a weird and eclectic filmography, just full of oddball movies. And I haven't even seen most of them, but I'm just eager to dig into. I've been reading about some of them, and I'm some of them sound insane. There's a movie called Life Force, which is about space vampire vixens, which sounds bananas.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and he did Texas Chainsaw 2, which is almost a parody of the first Texas Chainsaw, and there's a lot of really cool stuff in there.
I mean. Poltergeist is almost a parody of horror movies. It's so goofy and silly.
Yeah, it is in
moments, at least.
But also, Poltergeist is legitimately scary. I think it's a really intense and scary movie. But it's also a great family horror movie too.
Right.
It's a movie that I watched when I was nine. Like,
you know? That seems bold, but yeah, they said.
I did. I watched it when I was 9, and I loved it. And it is like it was rated PG. Poltergeist was PG.
Yeah, they didn't have any other ratings though.
Movies were PG or they were X. There were no in between.
That's it. There's nothing.
Yeah. So I just wanted to say RIP Toby Hooper because that was very upsetting. And do you have any other thoughts, Mike, or should we move on into some discussions?
That's Toby Hooper is definitely one of those directors that I am, aware of and have seen. Oh, I think I've only seen or consciously seen Poltergeist and Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And
those were his two really big ones.
Yeah. And that like, it's the most iconic scene, I think, in Texas Chainsaw Massacre, just Leatherface dancing with the chainsaw in the sunset.
Yeah, the very last scenes, the smash cut to credits,
Yeah, and there's a incredible chapter in that book I've mentioned a couple times called Shock Value.
Yes.
By, I think, Robert Zinnemann is the author, that is about the production of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and it's crazy. And that's one of those, kind of Hollywood legend stories about how they filmed that in 115 degrees in a house in Texas by themselves and all this craziness. But if you're interested in any of that, definitely check out that chapter in that book.
Yeah, definitely.
But that's kind of it.
Cool beans. All right. So RIP to Toby Hooper. Let's move on into our discussions starting right now.
Watch this. These are my discussions. Just when I thought I said all I could say, my buddy and I talk about movies we see. These are my discussions. There is so much to see, you and me. So we're going to talk about movies for our discussions.
All right, it's time for our discussions here on Film Bookcast. And Mike, I know you've been wanting to talk about this for a while. We've alluded to the fact that we were going to talk about this for a few weeks. And then I think we were recording and we were like, hey, we should talk about this show. And we was like, well, it's about to end its season. So we might as well wait till the end of the season. But what do you want to talk about, Mike?
Yeah, this week I want to talk about Game of Thrones Season 7.
Yes.
And as you said, we normally do our mid-season check-in on whatever HBO show is going on. But it's only 7 episodes for this season, and we figured that would be weird to just talk about 3 episodes and then talk about 4 episodes.
Yeah.
So let's just talk about them all at once. And Season 7 of Game of Thrones, I have some mixed feelings on. Mostly, I'm really into it. But I can definitely recognize, the big complaint a lot of people have, the shift in tone of writing, now that, whatever their name is, David Benioff and D.B. Weiss, I think.
Yes. Yeah, that's them.
That's them. I can't remember their actual names. are now in complete control of writing the story and the episodes. I think they're writing everything. And a lot of people have criticized the show for the kind of dropping off of the kind of high political intrigue that is the staple of so much of the other seasons.
Yeah.
That said, I can definitely recognize that and recognize the lack of that, and also really just be glad we're fucking pedal to the metal. Let's conclude this story finally. Because when I think back on seasons 4 and 5, we're a lot of great stuff. The beginning of season 6, a lot of cool stuff is happening, but a lot of it is nothing happening.
Right.
And finally, the end of season 6, we literally blow up all of the unimportant plot lines. And it's my favorite thing that's ever happened. I think of that as a giant middle finger to George R.R. Martin and his meandering stories.
Yeah.
That said, I kind of miss a little bit of it in season 7. Season 7 trades off a lot of that kind of thing for spectacle and action. And I still think I'm still on board, though. I think a lot of that spectacle and action is incredible and a sight to behold, and there's a lot of fun and there's excitement. I still have a couple gripes, but I'm interested to hear what you thought of this season before I mention some of those gripes.
Okay, yeah, I will say I feel like a lot of the problems that people had with the season were also present last season in season 6, like the quicker pace and the things moving a lot faster. I feel like that was there in season 6. I think it's a little more amplified here in season 7. I think partially because we only have 7 episodes instead of 10.
Yeah.
So we have less time to get through the stuff, although the episodes are usually a little bit longer in this season than they are in previous ones. But I thought it was a blast. I thought the season was so good.
Yeah.
Maybe things moved a little fast and certain stuff wasn't as concrete as it could have been, but just every payoff was satisfying. Every character meeting for the first time or character reunion was the best. And HBO throwing around that dragon money this season, man. And it totally shows. It is so good. And
it's showing up in a big way. Yeah. My big complaint is this season seven felt a lot like they were writing. I don't know how to explain this without it sounding really dumb. They're writing with the audience's expectations in mind, and you kind of always are writing like that, I think, right, for the most part. But this one, they're one wink short of like just looking at the camera. Like they're so close to being, yeah, the Office with some of these things.
I get you. I mean, I think part of what people dislike about this season is that Game of Thrones is a show that was built on subversion of expectations, right?
Like, yes,
it's the fantasy show where the noble character that's supposed to be your hero dies at the end of the first season, right? Like, that's,
right. Right.
And that happens throughout the entire show, up through, I think, the end of season five. And then in season six, you don't really have that as much. You start having, like, these heroic characters who you've seen struggle and be defeated over and over again over five seasons start to actually win.
Right.
And I think that almost has to happen. I don't think, like just subverting expectations is not sustainable as a narrative forever, And
so, yeah.
And yeah. I think that's definitely a narrative technique you can use, but it's not something you can go to the well to every time. Mm-hmm. And there is a satisfaction in seeing things pay off that have been set up in certain ways,
yeah. No, I definitely agree. There's at least one instance I can't think of. I know I was going to think of two. I can't remember the second one. But I don't know how spoilery we want to get.
Let's go into fucking full spoilers.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Full spoiler town.
Anybody who wants to avoid, skip ahead like 5-10 minutes.
Yeah. Okay. So if I'm in the episode Beyond the Wall, one of my favorite episodes of the whole season so far.
Yeah.
When they kind of have this Magnificent Seven moment.
Yes.
But there's the moment where Tormund almost dies or is looking like he's going to die.
That was dumb.
I hated it. I hated it so much. I hated all
dumb.
Of that.
Yeah.
But that was just pulls me out of so much of the show where it's like, oh, fucking really? Come yeah. on. And I feel like there's a lot of that. Not a lot of. Yeah. I don't want to say that.
No,
there's a bit of that going on this season,
yeah,
where they're writing explicitly with the assumption of the audience's expectations. And it's not even – they're like subverting our subversion. I don't know how many layers you want to do that, because we expect them to subvert like, oh, the heroic character will die. And that's – which is a subversion in itself. And then they – subverted again by just going with the regular trope.
Yes.
It feels so weird.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like because that happens a couple times this season. There's a moment where fucking Bronn, it looks like Bronn dies, right, where he like pushes Jaime out of the fire of the dragon's
right.
fire breath or whatever, and it looks like it hits Bronn for a second, and then he's alive mm-hmm. in the next episode and he's fine. And it's I feel like that happens a lot this season, where like it's
yeah.
kind of playing on your knowledge that Game of Thrones is the show that kills off characters left and right, except it's not
yeah.
doing that this season.
And it's winking to you while saving all the characters, which pisses me off so much.
Yeah, I get that. And I also kind of dislike that. I thought the moment with Bronn played out fine. The moment with Tormund, yeah. I thought, was really bad.
Mm-hmm.
Especially because I feel like, with these kind of deaths, like, I hate the fake-out deaths. I think that's what bugs me. Like, if you're going to kill off a character, kill him off, but like also do it in a narratively justifiable way. Like, that would have been a really unsatisfying way for Tormund to go.
Yeah.
And so even when that moment starts, like, I know he's not going to die, because like there's no way like they're just going to kill off Tormund like that. There's going to be more to his death than just that,
Yeah. And even that episode where Bronn saves Jaime, it ends with him sinking in his plate armor at the bottom of a river. Maybe Jaime's going to die. And then, no, of course he's
of course
not going to just drown
die.
In his yeah. most undignified way. So stuff like that. And the Sansa Arya Littlefinger plot, I felt was fucking dumb.
I think that could have used like an extra scene or two to just kind of more explain what was going on.
Yes.
But I will say I will contend that it might have been dumb, but it got me when Sansa, like, they stage like that fake trial at the,
right.
at the end. Arya's like there, and Sansa's like, "You stand accused of this, Lord Baelish," and the entire room like turns to Baelish like, whoa.
Yeah, no, that moment, like, the payoff for it was cool. I'm glad that happened. Like, that was an interesting way to do that, to like have that resolve.
Yeah.
But I felt like it would have been so much cooler to let the audience in on Bran just telling them that he knows all this shit. Yeah. Let us in on the Stark fucking revenge plot against Littlefinger. That would have been awesome instead of playing on our expectations that the Starks are dumb sometimes and Sansa's gonna kill Arya because she's in Littlefinger's pocket, you know? Like,
right. Yeah, like we never bought for a second that Sansa would kill Arya, so why even try to do that? Yeah.
Exactly.
But yeah, I do like that Bran is just some like stone kid on acid all the time. That's a fun that's a fun character trait.
I mean, it's the best moment when Sam Tarly comes in and he's like, oh, did you know about this thing? Right after Bran tells him he knows everything. Bran didn't know about it. Like, yes. Great. Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah, that was also, I think I tweeted about that episode. I remember I was talking about Twin Peaks earlier in the summer, and I mentioned that like I got like one of my most retweeted tweets because I tweeted about Twin Peaks and like made a joke about it. I had a similar thing going on with this Game of Thrones where I tweeted about that scene where it was like Sam walking in and he's talking to Bran and it's like, hey Bran, what you been up to this summer? And Bran's like, I'm the three-eyed raven now, I see everything. And it's just and it says Sam, it's just a gif of John Oliver going, cool.
It's perfect. It's such a weird thing. I can't wait till Sam becomes the most important character, and it's gonna be the best.
Yeah, I mean, Sam did discover. Well, actually, Sam's girlfriend discovered the most like, revelatory part of this entire season.
Yeah,
which is that Jon Snow is the rightful heir to the Iron Throne, which is insane. So I love that they discovered that Jon Snow is a Targaryen. And they cut that to the montage of John, they cut that with a montage of Jon having sex with Dany, who is also a Targaryen.
Yeah, who's his aunt. Yeah. Real weird. Real interesting choice there.
I think we joked about this before, like earlier, like as the season was airing. Like if Game of Thrones becomes like the pro-incest show, like...
Yeah, what a turnaround. What an interesting arc for a show to take.
What a weird spin. But I think there's a really interesting place this could take it where, you know, I feel like part of what the show has been doing a little bit is establishing Dany as like probably the person who will end up on the throne at the end. Right. Otherwise, why have we been watching her for 8 years? I think this season and this season in particular has kind of set up like the fact that like she doesn't she can be cruel sometimes. She's you know powerful with the dragons. You know she burns those Tarleys to a crisp and all that. And
right.
I feel like you know with the incestual relationship that she has with Jon Snow, I feel like if she does end up on the Iron Throne at the end and Jon Snow is her king. Like, I feel like that could just be, I feel like that could be a really defeatist ending of, you know, because that's exactly what Cersei and Jaime are, you know? And so it could just be like the next iteration of that, like the people they've been fighting the entire time. And it's just like this kind of defeatist ending of like, yeah, power is basically the same. Nothing ever changes.
America's a country, now pay me.
Killing them softly ending. So I think there is a lot of interesting directions the show could take.
Did I say America's a country? He says America's a business. Yeah. Now pay me. There we go.
America's a business, not a country. Yeah, there it is. But yeah, I mean the show could also end with like Jon and Dany sacrificing themselves in battle with the White Walkers and Cersei still staying on the throne. Like that could happen. Yeah,
I think we're gonna have a really fucking dumb. They have a baby that's the best of both of them, and then he becomes king or whatever, some stupid shit. We're gonna go full on fantasy trope land. But no, I hope not. Yeah. That's, I'm mostly joking about that, but it's possible.
Yeah, I want Hot Pie to win. I think Hot Pie should win the entire show. I just want to throw, like, before we move on from Game of Thrones, motherfucking Ice Dragon in the house.
With its Godzilla breath.
I was like that during that episode when the like as soon as the White Walkers like knocked the dragon out of the sky, I was like, no way. Like I hadn't even considered the idea that they could possibly zombify one of Dany's dragons. And as soon as it fell from the sky, I was like, it was all I wanted.
I do appreciate the foreshadowing of the zombie bears earlier in the episode that like, oh, it doesn't have to be a person. I thought that was a pretty good use of that. It's Ice Dragon, sure. Yeah. Why not?
And it's one of those things like back when season 2 of Game of Thrones was on and it ended with like these like marching White Walkers, like Sam is like in the field and you see the White Walkers marching. That was like the last shot of season 2.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that aired like pretty shortly after the finale of The Walking Dead. And I remember like thinking to myself or tweeting out something like Game of Thrones just did Walking Dead better than Walking Dead ever did. and then when the Ice Dragon came up, I remembered something I had thought about The Walking Dead a long time ago, because there was a bit in The Walking Dead where they had kind of set up like a potential cow zombie, and they didn't go through with it. Like, it was just a regular cow. But I was like, man, I wish I could have seen a cow zombie. Yeah. And then Game of Thrones fucking does the animal zombie thing. And
not it does it good.
And not only is it a cow zombie, it's a fucking dragon zombie. Yeah. So I was on board with the Ice Dragon. Fair. And there's just so much fun. Like, I really loved seeing like John and Danny interact with each other this season. Because they had never met in the show before, and like, you know, their plot lines had been so separate for so long. Like, it's just cool to see them together. And even by the end of the season, like, almost every plot line is together in King's Landing for a little while. And I think that's cool. Yeah. Also, Euron Greyjoy, biggest Evanescence fan in the world. I don't know, just the way he's like dressed up in all leather and he has like the eyeliner on. He just looks like an Evanescence fan.
Oh my God. You know how I know you work at an alternative rock radio station?
Because of that, yeah.
Because of that.
But yeah, and all the battle, there's a lot of battle sequences this season, and they were all like excellent. I thought like Euron Greyjoy attacking the ships, and the attack of Casterly Rock, and I mean the battle with the White Walkers and the dragon. Like, there's a lot of cool stuff happening this season.
Yeah, I'm definitely excited for season 8, which who knows when the fuck we're gonna get it. Apparently.
I've heard potentially 2019, which is, you know, insane.
Which seems crazy. I'm nervous that they are going to pull that. And with the amount of, bad blood that they might have earned this season, I know I've seen a lot more kind of like anger at just the writing and like all this stuff this season than I had expected to see.
I also saw that, yeah.
So they might have lost a lot of good grace with people, and if they now wait a year and a half, they might not be able to ever earn it back for the last season. So hopefully they get on it and it's out by next summer, but we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I want them to take their time and do what, like, the best they could possibly do with the season.
Yeah,
so,
definitely. That's true.
But definitely looking forward to Game of Thrones Season 8. So, Mike, is there any last Game of Thrones thoughts you want to throw out there?
No, I think we've talked about it enough. It's time. We can't put it off any longer.
Okay.
Mike,
well, I do want to put it off just a little bit longer, so I got a couple movies that I want to got a couple movies I want to throw out there for my discussions. I wanted to mention that I saw Good Time a couple weeks ago, and have you heard of Good Time, Mike?
I feel like I have, but I don't remember.
This is the new movie directed by the Safdie brothers, who are a duo who I didn't really know before this movie, but this stars Robert Pattinson. He's a guy trying to get his brother out of jail after a bank robbery goes wrong. This movie is incredible.
Like, wow.
It's so good. It's very similar to Martin Scorsese's After Hours, if you've seen that. It's a one crazy night in New York where everything goes wrong kind of movie. And it's just really intense, and it's really darkly comedic throughout. And Robert Pattinson, just a force to be reckoned with in Good Time, man.
Wow, what a sense.
Yeah, it is great. Like, 10 years ago, he and Kristen Stewart were, like, widely considered terrible because of the Twilight movies, right? Like, when those were coming out, like, everybody was like, these kids suck, like, and I really think, like, it was just the material they were given, I think. Like, they were giving the performance that material warranted. You know, since then, they've both done so much really good independent work. Like, Kristen Stewart was in Adventureland. She was in this great movie called Clouds of Sils Maria. She was just in Personal Shopper this year, which I haven't seen yet, but I've heard it's amazing. And Robert Pattinson was in a couple of Cronenberg movies. He was in Cosmopolis and Maps of the Stars. And now he's in this. And, I think they've really established themselves as some of the best actors of their generation. And it's crazy. Taylor Lautner, not so much. But, like,
not so much.
But, like, those two, really good stuff. So, yeah, really enjoyed Good Time. Really good movie. Also saw Wind River, which is the new movie directed by Taylor Sheridan, who is the writer of Sicario and Hell or High Water. So I know you're a big fan of those movies, Mike.
Yeah, yeah. No, I knew Wind River looked really good.
Yeah. Yeah, well, this stars Jeremy Renner and Elizabeth Olsen, and it's about a murder that takes place on an Indian reservation. Olsen plays an FBI agent investigating the crime. Renner is a local assisting her on the case. And I think it's a pretty solid crime drama in a pretty unique setting. It doesn't quite reach those other two movies for me. Hell or High Water, I think, is my favorite out of these three. But they all kind of form like a loose trilogy of similarly themed movies. And so it's definitely worth checking out if you like those movies. You will probably really dig Wind River, I think. Because I know you were huge in Sicario. I remember that one. And this one's actually directed by Taylor Sheridan, who wrote those two movies. So definitely of interest. And then I have one last one to talk about. And this one's kind of a bummer. Death Note, which is the new movie directed by Adam Wingard, who I love. I love
Adam your boy.
Wingard. Yeah, my boy Adam Wingard. He made You're Next, The Guest. I liked Blair Witch, Mike. I am the guy...
I remember.
I am the guy who liked his Blair Witch movie. I am an apologist of Adam Wingard. I love Adam Wingard, and he made a Netflix original movie. This movie is out on Netflix right now, adapted from one of the only anime series that I've actually watched. Like I watched Death Note as a kid. I saw that Death Note was everywhere in high school. I don't know if it was the same for you.
Not so much.
Okay. I mean, I was a year younger than you in high school, a year or two. Something like that. But in any case, Death Note was all over the place in my high school. Like, you could not escape Death Note. Like, even if you didn't, if you weren't a nerd, like, you knew what Death Note was. Like, it was a huge thing. You would see people in my high school carrying like Death Note notebooks.
That's the craziest and coolest thing ever. Yeah. Well, I've ever heard.
I mean, the implications of that are kind of terrifying. But yeah, I mean, are you? You're familiar with Death Note, Mike?
In a kind of cursory way. I know the basic plot and everything. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, and there's no other way to say this other than this movie is just pretty terrible. Like, it's really bad. It tries to stuff a lot into one movie. Like, the original series is 37 episodes, which is adapted from an even longer manga. And this movie is like an hour and 40 minutes. Like, this movie is like kind of takes all that. And it doesn't, it's not the entire series, but it's like the first like third or whatever. And it does everything it can to kind of absolve Light, the main character, morally for a lot of the shit he's done. And that is not good for what this movie is. And it instead pairs him up with this psycho girlfriend played by Margaret Qualley from The Leftovers, the girl who played Jill. You know, she's the one who kind of bears most of the brunt for the evil shit that goes down in this movie. And it's such an odd choice, and like, she's kind of playing a version of a character that was in the original series who also had a Death Note, but like, from what I remember, and I don't remember Death Note the show that well, I had to look up like Wikipedia synopses of like things that happened on the show afterwards,
right?
But like, from what I gathered, like, she also had a Death Note, but like, in the show, Light kind of manipulated her to do his bidding, so like, he was still the one who was like the bad guy. And that's kind of the interesting thing about Death Note is like, he was the bad guy, but he was the main character. You were following him, and like, you were watching this cat and mouse game between him and L, the private detective, who's like hunting him down. And the guy who plays L, by the way, Lakeith Stanfield, phenomenal in this movie. I mean, Lakeith Stanfield, he's kind of made a name for himself recently. He was on Atlanta. He was in Get Out recently too. He's been in a lot of good stuff, and he's great as L. Also, Willem Dafoe is in this movie as Ryuk, the voice of Ryuk, who is the demon that is kind of the Death Note, the guy who runs the demon who is in control of Death Note. The demon in this movie looks terrible. Like, it looks really...
Really? Looks interesting.
I don't think there's a version... I don't think it's a live-action version of this demon that could possibly exist that looks good. You know, it's...
Fair. Yeah. Knowing what it looks like in the manga and the anime, it's a crazy character to try to make look like a thing.
It's not something that translates well to a live action setting. I think it would have been better if like you had Willem Dafoe as like this disembodied voice that appears in Light's head or something. Like, that would have been cooler. It might have been, you know, similar to Harry Osborn in the Spider-Man movies, but
yeah. Well, because I did see, I think, of the trailer for it. He's kind of just like a shadow, there's a shot of Ryuk in the shadows, and it's just the pointy hair and the glowy eyes, and that looked awesome.
A lot of the times, it is in silhouette. Okay. So there is that, because I think they knew that it looks bad.
Right. Yeah.
But then in other times it is not, and it looks really rough. but yeah, and as is, it's just a very surface level adaptation that starts off as like a Final Destination ripoff, and that was kind of fun for a little while. Like, it's just you know, watching people die in increasingly ridiculous ways, and like, I'm all about the Final Destination movies. I love those movies.
Sure.
I'm a really big fan of at least the first three. This movie just kind of devolves into nonsense, and the ending just becomes like genuinely laughable. Like, it's really bad, just like super contrived and like idiotic. And so Death Note, it's a bummer. And it's kind of the first Adam Wingard movie that I'm like, I really can't recommend. And that's a shame. He is directing the next. He's directing Godzilla versus Kong. I'm still on board for that. Although I've heard it takes more cues from Kong Skull Island than it does Godzilla, in which case, I don't know, but
we'll see.
In any case, that is Death Note, and we should move on, Mike. Let's get into our featured review. Here it is, Twin Peaks, The Return.
This is the water, and this is the well. Drink full and ascend. The horse is the white of the eyes and dark within. This is the water, and this is the well. Drink full and ascend. The horse is the white of the eyes and dark within. This is the water, and this is the well. Drink full and ascend. The horse is the white of the eyes, dark within.
All right, Twin Peaks The Return, Mike. This is the new Showtime miniseries. 18 episodes, started in May, just finished up last week. Every episode directed by David Lynch, written by David Lynch and Mark Frost. And I'm going to list off the people who I figured are the main cast members of the show. Like, the people who I consider the main cast members of the show, despite the fact there are hundreds of cast members on the show. Yeah. And all of them contribute in their own small way. Kyle MacLachlan, obviously. David Lynch himself is probably the second most important character in the show. Miguel Ferrer, Krista Bell, Laura Dern, Naomi Watts, Robert Knepper, Jim Belushi, Robert Forster, Kimmy Robertson, Michael Horst, Dana Ashbrook, Harry Goaz, and Cheryl Lee, among others. Those are the ones who I would consider the mainest of the main cast members of this show. And there are others who maybe even have like the same amount of screen time or the same amount of scenes, but I just don't know. Like, I'm mostly including people who are involved in the main Cooper storyline,
right?
In that synopsis right there. So the IMDb plot synopsis for Twin Peaks: The Return reads,
I'm excited for this. Sorry,
it's like 15 words. It just picks up 25 years after the inhabitants of a quaint northwestern town are stunned when their homecoming queen is murdered.
So it's the original series.
Yeah, it's the plot synopsis for the original show, but 25 years later. Okay. Yeah. So Mike, now I spent much of last year watching the original series of Twin Peaks, those first two seasons, a show which I had always wanted to watch since I've always liked David Lynch. And this new season kind of gave me the kick I needed to get into the show. And in the process, it sparked something of an obsession for me, as you're aware. I watched the original show. I watched the movie Fire Walk With Me. I read the extra books like The Secret Diary of Laura Palmer and The Secret History of Twin Peaks. And I can't count the amount of online articles that I've read just about the show, theorizing about certain elements that would come into play. And even with all that, I had no idea what to expect from this new season. And that feeling ended up continuing throughout the entire season. I had no idea what to expect at any point. During the 18 hours that Twin Peaks The Return was playing in my eyeballs. I never had a firm grasp on where the show was going. And anytime it seemed like I was about to, the show would pivot and become something else entirely. And that was a pretty insane experience. So, Mike, I mean, you've obviously watched all the Twin Peaks stuff, right?
Yes, yes. I've watched the original two seasons a few years ago for the first time and blew my fucking mind open, just everything that it is. Just to see kind of the it's often credited as revolutionizing and giving us modern TV, modern like procedural cop dramas, which is so funny to think about because it's so not that. but it was so uniquely David Lynch to have a person like that make a primetime network TV show that was a smash hit that, you know, like event television in 1991 or whatever it was is kind of what, you know, it revolutionized TV in that way, to have people be able to just, we're going to make a thing, which is, we don't have Game of Thrones. We don't have The Leftovers. We don't have Lost. We don't have all of these shows that are just so weird and unique don't exist without David Lynch and Twin Peaks, which is incredible to think about. And then it's coming back. It came out. It was almost 25. Well, it was originally going to be 25 years to the day, I think.
I believe. Yeah. So, I mean, they announced that they were doing the new season, I think, back in 2014. Yeah. With like a cryptic tweet from David Lynch that said that Gummy You Like is coming back in style.
Right. Which is amazing.
I think I think it said hashtag damn fine coffee. And so people were like freaking out, and then it was officially announced like Showtime wanted to do a new season of Twin Peaks. And there was a whole lot of back and forth about that. I mean, first of all, the fact that David Lynch was doing this, because David Lynch had not directed anything at that point in 8 years, in 2014. That was Inland Empire came out in 2006. And now it's 2017. So it's been 11 years since David Lynch has actually directed any, like, feature movies. Narrative work. Yeah, any narrative work from David Lynch. There's been a couple of things here and there. There's been, like, you know, he shot commercials. He shot a I've mentioned this a few times, but he did a Duran Duran concert that is which is actually available to watch on Netflix, by the way, his Duran Duran concert. And I may watch that pretty soon. And yeah, so I was pretty excited. I mean, because that when they announced the new show was coming back, I was excited, but I had never watched Twin Peaks at that point. I was just excited for more David Lynch stuff because it had been so long since David Lynch had done anything. And that was the exciting thing to me. And that kind of gave me the kick to start to catch up on the old Twin Peaks.
Right. Yeah. And we get Twin Peaks, The Return, 18 hours. It feels a lot like it's going to sound similar to my response to Game of Thrones season 7. I kind of have mixed feelings about it. I know a lot of it I really like. A lot of it is absolutely fucking David Lynch just jerking off on television. You thought this is what this was? No, it's this now. This is what TV is. This is what we can do with it. And in that regard, I am blown away again. It's crazy that he's going to do the same thing that he did with the first series, with the original season. Yeah. And just kick the door open and change how we can view TV as a thing.
Yeah, this is the next 25 years of TV right here. Like, this is
It's happening again, as the giant says.
Yes.
Which is it's insane. Everything it's crazy to think about. He made a show about him making a show, but it's not about that in any way, which is crazy. But your kind of intro explains, I feel like a Luddite saying this, but you kind of gave your cast list was the quote unquote main Cooper cast, even though there are so many other people that have equal plots or equal amount of plot and screen time. But so much of that it does nothing, literally nothing for me. And I feel like nothing for the show, which is hard. It's a hard thing for me to say because as a person that is a fan of David Lynch, I know he does everything with a purpose and so much of it is carefully crafted, or at least the illusion of that. So it hurts me to have to feel that way. Like, I am disappointed in myself for responding this way to how the show is. But that's just my gut reaction to it. I know this is going to be a thing I'm going to have to watch two or three more times to even begin to fathom what I saw.
Yeah.
So it's kind of hard to make a judgment this early, right? And I watched it yesterday.
I mean, that's the thing. You just finished it yesterday. And I watched it, I watched the finale as it aired. And our plan was to possibly review it the next day. And then you hadn't caught up at that point anyway, but I texted you and I was like, listen, we should record a few days later because we're going to need time to process this. And then you ended up putting off even more time and then we went watching yesterday.
We don't need to talk about that.
But
yeah, so that's just kind of my overall response. I'm sure it's going to be an hour before we get to any kind of conclusion with this. But I'm going to need you to guide me through this meditation, Mike, of Twin Peaks: The Returns, as someone who has had time to process what the fuck we just watched.
Yeah. So I think Twin Peaks: The Return is an incredible achievement and maybe a once in a lifetime TV show. I don't think we'll ever see anything like it again. And it's going to spawn a whole new wave of obsessive. Some people who will go on to make their own shows that may be influenced by Twin Peaks, but they're never going to be Twin Peaks. Like, this is going to be the show to look up to forever, or at least for a long time. This season elevated Twin Peaks into a top five show of all time for me. I think of my five favorite shows of all time: The Simpsons, Community, Twin Peaks, Mad Men, and Arrested Development. That's my five right now.
Three of those don't exist without Twin Peaks, and one of them's The Simpsons.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I was thinking about Twin Peaks actually, and it was weird. So I was thinking about this before the finale aired. I was trying to like kind of fathom, like, cause I've been so in love with the season of Twin Peaks, and I've seen like the kind of same reaction that you've had online and stuff where people have been like, I don't really understand why I'm watching this part or whatever. And I've just been so enthralled by everything that the show has thrown at me. And I've been wondering why that was. And I was thinking about Twin Peaks in the context of my other favorite shows, and I kept coming back to Community for some reason. It's weird because Community, I feel like what really draws me into the season of Twin Peaks is that it like deconstructs the way that you can tell a story in a primetime, in a drama series.
Right.
It deconstructs the idea of prestige television and reinvents it into its own unique device. And I think Community does that for sitcoms in the same way. Like Community deconstructs sitcom tropes and kind of builds on them in its own unique way. And I was honestly thinking, like, the only show I can think of that would even attempt to do something like episode 8 of Twin Peaks is Community.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, Twin Peaks is the Community of TV, man.
Exactly.
No, but you're absolutely correct. That is 100%. That's what I meant when I said that it's a show. David Lynch made a show about him making a show, even though it's not about that.
Right.
It's insane. It's so hard to wrap my mind around.
Yeah, but I think I just like watching this. Like David Lynch, to me, is just so confident in what he's doing, like every step of the way. So even when what he's doing flies against any kind of narrative logic, and that happens a lot on this show. You know, I feel like, you know, there's a lot of things where you're just watching, and it's like, oh, okay, now I'm watching Ed and Norma for some reason, and you know, now I'm watching these characters who I've never seen before and will never see again. And
yeah. Dr. Jacoby's yelling at me. Sure.
Yeah. I think he does. That happens a couple times throughout the season where Dr. Jacoby's doing his show. And I'm pretty sure it's the exact same show every time. Like, I don't think it changes.
Maybe, I never noticed. If you put it all together, it's just one long
bit. I think it's re-showing the same clip.
It totally might be. I don't even know.
Because it definitely does it twice where it shows Nadine watching Dr. Jacoby's show.
Yeah, that's definitely.
And her like sipping on the like a Coke or something, and like just like he's such a genius. Like it's almost the exact same. So a lot of the stuff about the show just flies in the face of any kind of narrative logic. And I think part of that is that David Lynch is a director who has just always been obsessed with the human mind and the dream state. And that's something that was present in the original show. Like that's something that was definitely a factor there. Like a lot of that show had to deal with what Cooper's dreams told him about Laura Palmer. But this is truly the product of the guy who made Mulholland Drive, right? Like that's, you know, that is a movie where, you know, spoilers from Mulholland Drive, the first 2 hours of that movie are a dream sequence. And the rest is like recontextualizing what you just saw in the quote unquote real world, if it can be that, and I feel like Twin Peaks, The Return, especially by the time you get to the end, it makes you question the entire reality of the entire series.
Yes.
And it's really insane and bonkers in that way. And we'll talk about that a lot in spoilers, I'm sure. I did want to talk about Kyle MacLachlan a lot, because it cannot be said enough just how incredible he is on this show.
It feels a lot like his Portlandia performances really informed his performance this season.
Yeah.
Which is hilarious and amazing.
Yeah, I mean, he's asked to play like at least three or four different variations of the same character, and it just seems effortless. Like every version just feels like distinct, and it feels like, grounded in like a certain kind of reality, but like not actual reality, but like the kind of Twin Peaks reality that exists.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
And a lot of the original cast members return from the old show, although the stories are often like ancillary to the main action, which I think frustrated a lot of people. Right,
yeah.
Like there's a lot of characters in the original show who didn't show up for a long time, and when they did, their stories didn't really integrate into the main plot line. They were just kind of like, oh, hey, it's this character. And I found Audrey's story to be like the biggest point of contention for a lot of people.
Yes.
On this show, and I get it. I totally get why that is. But I think I really think that pays off really well at the end. In a way, like it's not resolved, you know, but I feel like just the image that you leave Audrey on is so haunting that I feel, and it kind of informs what you've seen before with her. She's only in like, I think, four episodes of the show. And she's such a major character in the original series. And in a kind of surprise, Gordon Cole and Albert ends up playing the biggest part this time.
Yeah. Which honestly, like, I kind of really loved. Yeah. I loved being able to see this, like, kind of send off to Miguel Ferreira yeah. as Albert in this amazing performance. And with Cole, like, Albert and Cole are such a small part of the original series. But they're so much fun when they're on screen yeah. in those moments. That it was kind of a joy to get to watch them together for like the whole series, all 18 yeah. hours of this movie.
It was
a show.
Yeah. I mean, Lynch has said he sees it as an 18-hour movie. And it is a TV show, but like, it was filmed all at once and then yeah. they kind of chopped it up, as episodes in the editing room. So it wasn't like seen as an episodic show. It was just like an 18-hour narrative that they kind of split into parts.
Right.
And the way they do that is they shot a bunch of Roadhouse performances, or like music. They got a bunch of musicians together to just play songs at the Roadhouse, mm-hmm. which has the best booking agent in the world.
In history, yeah.
For that small Washington town, it's pretty insane. And yeah, so there's like bands like Nine Inch Nails and Eddie Vedder shows up at one point, and it's like some huge names showing up at the Roadhouse, which is pretty cool. And so almost every episode ends with like a performance at the Roadhouse, and I really love that as a way to just kind of ease you out of the world of Twin Peaks. Cause I think I told you, like, as I was watching the season, like every episode of the show, like I would feel myself like getting caught up in my breath, like catching up. Like I would, mm-hmm. I would start to run out of breath cause I would be like holding it so long or something. And like, by the time you're at the Roadhouse and you see like the credits start to roll and it just says starring Kyle MacLachlan, you're like, oh man,
let me listen to this 4-minute Eddie Vedder song.
Yes, exactly. yeah. And that was pretty great. And yeah, I mean, going back to Lynch as Gordon Cole and Miguel Ferrer as Albert, you know, in the original show, like they're mostly like their background characters, like they're supporting characters. They're in a few episodes each.
Yeah.
And I think they're mostly used to comedic effect on the original show. Here, mm-hmm. they have the entire range of drama to their disposal. Yeah. They're really funny a lot of the time. There's a lot of really intense moments featuring them. There's a lot of really insane moments featuring them. And it's just they're just really terrific together. And it gave me a real appreciation for Miguel Ferrer. Who was a character that I liked in the original series, but it wasn't one that like really popped to mind when I thought of like my favorite characters from that show. And suddenly he became like one of my favorites through this version of him.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's got one of the best lines in the original series when, I don't remember exactly what happens, but I think Cooper confronts him or something like that. And he gives that like shouted response in the words of Gandhi and Dr. King before again,
yes.
about how he's a pacifist and how he doesn't hate him. He loves him. And it's like one of the best moments of the show.
Yes. It's incredible. Yeah. Cooper says to he's like shouting at Truman, I think. Cooper like,
oh, that's
what it was. As Albert leaves, Truman likes like, huh, and Cooper like turns to Truman and he's like, Albert's path is a long and difficult one.
It's great. It's so great.
Yeah, it is pretty great. And I think now that we're talking about Truman, I think there is part of what really makes the season work for me is that there's a visible aging of the cast. And the knowledge yeah. that several of them have died, a lot of them are in poor health because they're really old at this point. Like it's, mm-hmm. Been 25 years since the original show. And, some of them died while filming the season or right after, like Miguel Ferrer as Albert, or right. Catherine E. Coulson as the Log Lady. And the return almost seems like David Lynch, like reflecting on his entire life and kind of what happens when it's close to the end. And, that's, very apparent in a scene with the Log Lady towards the end. Which is just
all of her scenes are haunting and very moving.
Yeah, you can see how close she is to death while she's like talking. It's really just insane. And also Warren Frost, who played Doc Hayward in the original show, he died after the season finished filming, but he appears in a Skype cameo at one point. Robert Forster talks to him.
Oh, right, yeah.
And then there's characters who died way before the season started. David Lynch was able to make like appearances from them throughout the show, like Don S. Davis, who played Colonel Briggs, Frank Silva, who played Bob, mm-hmm. and Jack Nance, who played Pete Martell, appears in archive footage, and of course David Bowie, who was in Firewalk with Me, the movie, and whose character is very significant to the show. Like he plays a pretty significant part for like the show, and of course like David Bowie died before the season started, so they couldn't have him. And the way they work around that is just perfectly David Lynch.
mm-hmm. I'm sure we'll talk about it.
Yes. And a lot of them all appear through like archive footage or like repurposed, recontextualized, footage. Like, that kind of makes the characters do new things in certain ways, especially Frank Silva and Don S. Davis. Like they have like, Maybe they use like archive footage of a character, him saying something, but his face doing a different thing, and they use different things there. So it's really cool. But yeah, and in any given moment, like Twin Peaks: The Return, it just could either have me like laughing hysterically, like there's a lot of really funny moments,
yeah,
in this show, or it could have me overcome with emotion. You know, I cried several times throughout the season, or paralyzed by sheer terror. Which, you know, I was just talking I saw It this weekend, the new Stephen King adaptation.
Right.
And I was talking with the people who I saw it with, because, you know, the people I saw it with were scared by It. And I was not, you know, but I enjoyed the movie. I had a lot of fun with it. But it's because I watched so many horror movies that it's tough. It's tough at this point to actually, quote unquote, like, scare me, even though I really enjoy watching them.
Right.
But David Lynch really gets under my skin. In really intense ways. And Twin Peaks: The Return, fucking chilling. at any given moment, like I could be like in a pretty safe spot with the show, and then suddenly things will just snap, and I'll see some like horrific shit happen in the span of a second, and you know I won't understand the world anymore, and I will be terrified, and you know it's insane.
I like I said, I feel disappointed and bad to say that I, you know, a lot of that weird meandering which is stuff, and like I don't, you know, it reminded me, this season reminded me a lot of season two, or the back half of season two of the original series.
Man. Slam.
And, but like and I don't mean it in that kind of like I do mean it in that like weird pointless way where that a lot of weird stuff is just kind of happening in the back half of season two. This definitely, The Return, feels like there is somehow more cohesion than that. You know, it is, I think, David Lynch's touch in every episode and his vision that he knows what he's doing and is able to just change everything about your worldview in a frame, but at the same time, I guess I'm just one of those plebes that wanted the Cooper story. Just give me more of that first Cooper story. I want to know what's up with all that.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's kind of.
Yeah. I mean, that was kind of the thing. A lot of people were very upset that, you know, Colin McLaughlin is in the show throughout. But for the longest time, he is not playing our beloved Agent Dale Cooper.
He is definitely not.
And we will talk about that in spoilers. But yeah, there is a long stretch of time, like most of the show, where he's playing entirely different characters. And that is frustrating at first. You know, I feel like, you know, at first, you know, I was into it, and then there was a period where I was kind of frustrated with it, and then it kind of came back around. And I feel like that's kind of the thing. If you're not coming back around, then this season could be trying for
you. I feel like I didn't come around until episodes 16, 17, and 18.
Really?
Yeah. I was kind of on board for the first, you know, like I was really on board for, you know, maybe the first 1 to 5, and then or maybe 1 to 4, and then kind of fell. I was like, real, okay, it's going to be one of these things. And I was kind of like ready to, you know, let it happen. Episode 8 changed the way television exists. and then we kind of don't really do, there's moments and glimmers of that happening in every episode or every other episode, maybe for me. But for the most part, I was kind of just watching it to watch it. And I wasn't getting the entertainment or enjoyment that I was expecting. And I think until 16, 17, 18, which I think are incredible. But I think it's going to be one of those things I need to go back and rewatch just with a different expectation and not watch it as an experience rather than watch it like, oh, man, I want to know what's up with Twin Peaks stuff. The story of that we were following in the first two seasons, and just kind of let it happen and wash over me. And I think I'll probably have a different perspective and reaction to it then.
Yeah.
Now that I have the whole thing, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that's part of the thing. You know, I feel like some people were upset with this season. It's been a divisive season of TV for sure. And I think, you know, with, the Cooper stuff, I feel like there are people who are big fans of the original Twin Peaks, who are not that familiar with David Lynch's later work.
Yes, I definitely think that's true.
And so I think they were expecting, you know, kind of a trip down nostalgia lane, like it's a new Twin Peaks, like Cooper will be back, he'll solve a new case or something or whatever. And that is decidedly not what David Lynch had in mind at all.
And a lot of it seems to be fly explicitly in the face of that. And I feel like a lot of our kind of supporting cast moments are there just to make fun of us for wanting them. and I don't mean it as mean-spirited as that, But like you know, the whole Norma and Ed thing, like, kind of just exists for no reason. Her Norma or Shelley's daughter plot, like, doesn't go anywhere. Jerry Horn's literally lost in the wilderness the entire season, and it's hilarious, and I'm so glad that it exists and is that. But it feels like such a, like a kind of FU to, like, all, you know, like.
See, it didn't. I don't know. It didn't feel like an FU. I mean, I really, to me, it kind of becomes contextualized during the last episode of the show.
Yeah,
in a certain way, but it feels like it doesn't feel like an FU to me. It just feels like he is exploring these characters' lives, and they don't necessarily have to intertwine with what's going on with Cooper.
That's true. Yeah,
because some
they wouldn't.
Yeah,
in real life,
they
right?
would. They wouldn't in the original show. You know, in the original show, and most yeah. of the, like, a lot of the plot lines didn't intersect. And some of them did, and, like, when they do, it's pretty cool. And, like, even in this new show, like, some of the plot lines do intersect at points. Like, you see at the very end of episode 17, like, Jerry Horn is watching Evil Cooper through the woods, and it's like, oh,
Cooper Ganger, Doppelcoop.
Doppelcoop, yeah. But, yeah, I mean, just everything about the way the show is made, though. I mean, the sound design is just nothing short of incredible. Like, every sound that you hear in the show is some of the best you've ever heard. And the music, both Angelo Badalamenti's score and those songs that we play at the Roadhouse at the end of every episode, they're just perfect. And there's, like, this quick-fire editing that happens a lot of the time with when you're in the when you're in, like, the Red Room, or when you're in, like, this weird experimental phase of the show and all that stuff. But also, like, this languid pacing that, like, allows you to just soak it all in a lot of times. And that turned a lot of people off, too. But the original show had that, too. So I feel like if you were on board with it for the original show, you should be on board with it here.
That was definitely something that took me a long time to get over. About, you know, maybe 4 or 5 episodes before I was kind of just like, all right, this is just what the show is going to be, where we have 5 seconds between dialogue, like, between conversation, where we're just kind of looking at each other and then we're going to talk, and just kind of being at peace with that. Harry Dean Stanton's fucking the hero of the show for a long time,
man.
Which was awesome.
Yeah, fucking 91 just, years old, that dude, man.
Just crushing it, running his trailer park, like, yes. Always, which was awesome. It was so cool.
Yeah.
Everything bad happens to him or around him.
Yes. Yeah, he's great. I mean, the performances from everyone in the show, I think, are really great. Obviously, we mentioned McLachlan, who is doing, like, 6 performances at once, and he's awesome in all of them. Naomi Watts as Janie E is fantastic. I think Cheryl Lee is incredible in the show. Like, I feel like that's the biggest crime that exists, is that, you know, the original Twin Peaks exists, and Cheryl Lee was great on the show and in Fire Walk With Me, and she never really did that. Like, she never got big after that, you know?
Yeah, which is real weird.
Yeah, like, she could have been, like, a perfect horror scream queen for a while, you know? Like, her scream is the most haunting thing I've ever heard.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But, like, even, like, fucking Jim Belushi is great in this. Like, he's...
yeah,
and
yeah.
That's not a sentence you ever hear. Like, that's...
No. Yeah, his plot with, man, I don't remember the guy that plays his brother.
Robert Knepper. They play the Mitchum brothers.
Yes, they're hilarious and amazing. And, yeah. Like, I've never seen him in a role like this. Which is great.
Yes. And then it all does come to a head with a finale that will be just as divisive as the original finale for the show, you know, and that's kind of amazing, because the original finale ends in this massive cliffhanger for the show, several cliffhangers, in fact, and then the show is canceled. And then, when given the chance to make a movie to wrap up all those plot lines, David Lynch instead made a prequel and didn't wrap up any of the cliffhangers.
yeah, I definitely, that finale of season 2 is, those last 20 minutes are the most revolutionary parts of TV, or, you know, 20 minutes on television in 1990 or 91, whenever those aired.
Yeah.
And then, as we've said it a whole bunch of times already, he goes on 25 years later to make the most revolutionary 18 hours of television. But seriously, that finale of season 2 is I can't believe that fucking aired on Fox. Like, that aired on network TV.
I think ABC.
Was it ABC?
I think so.
Either way, it's a network. It's fucking crazy.
Yeah.
And you know, episode, the last 45 minutes of episode 8 will change TV. I think the last half hour or 45 minutes or so of episode 17 completely are the most bonkers, and to steal your favorite word, bonkers and bold things that he did this season. Which, oh man, well, I guess we'll get, I don't want to talk about it, but the specifics of it, but we'll tell spoilers. That moment, those 45 minutes or half hour, whatever it is, of 17 made 18 that much more disappointing for me.
I feel like I get that, because I remember watching it and being like so confused. Like, I remember watching it and thinking to myself, it was a 2 hour like event.
So right.
17, 18 aired on the same night. And, you know, it was a great decision, because I think if you had to wait a week between 17 and 18, I feel people would be furious at 18.
They would be throwing their TVs out the windows.
But I remember watching it and being like, you know, they started at 8 o'clock, and by 8:30, it felt like it was wrapping up. And I was like, man, they're wrapping up Flatlines a lot faster than I thought they would. Like, what are they going to do for the next hour and a half? And it turns out, not what I expected them to do.
Nope. What a twist.
Yeah, so we should definitely talk about, like, we got to talk about the finale, Mike. And I feel like at this point we're getting into spoiler territory. So maybe we should just move, like, let's move on into spoilers for Twin Peaks: The Return, starting right now. All right, spoilers for Twin Peaks: The Return, starting right now. So, Mike, is it future or is it past?
We're all just living in a dream.
Yeah. Did Cooper cross over into a parallel universe? Did he go to the future? Is he in the real world? There's a lot of theories going around about episode 18 of the show. But so we'll talk about, how it gets to that point. So I think what the show and what Firewalk With Me does is really get into the actual trauma that Laura Palmer experienced, right? And I feel like that's what it all comes back to for this entire show. And, you know, the first time we see her in the original show, she's dead. Like, she's a dead person.
Right.
And, you know, it being a network drama, it was still doing things that hadn't been done before, but it wasn't really able to delve into the psychology of Laura Palmer and the utter horror that she felt every day for years leading up to her death, you know, being repeatedly raped by her father. That's such a huge part of Firewalk With Me, and it's a huge part of this show by the time you get to the end of it. And that's a part that's the kind of underlying theme in the original series, but because it's a network TV show, I feel like a lot of people can overlook it. A lot of people look past it, especially because I feel like the original show kind of places more emphasis in the fact that her father was possessed by Bob. And so you're thinking like, it wasn't really her father. It was Bob possessing her father. And so, you kind of look past the actual trauma that she would have regardless of that.
I don't necessarily even remember that stuff or the trauma with her father and him raping her and stuff being in the series. I don't think that happens or is revealed or as you're saying, is not explicitly confronted until Fire Walk With Me, when David Lynch can just make a hard R movie.
I feel like it is definitely referenced in the series, but like, it's not, maybe not directly, like it's
right.
I think that's what you're saying. Yeah. And so because you have the Bob thing going on, because they mentioned that, I'm pretty sure they mentioned that Laura was raped like in her autopsy or something like early on. And that was, you know, so you kind of like, you kind of have to like put the pieces together for that, I guess. But, they kind of place more emphasis in the fact that like Bob is the one that possessed Leland and then Leland killed Laura. And, you know, I feel like what Firewalk With Me does and what this new show does is that it kind of places more emphasis on the idea that Bob, isn't necessarily like this all present evil. It just kind of brings out the evil in the person that it is. And so, you know, I feel like it amplifies whatever evil is inside whatever person it exists in. And so that stuff, like Leland raping his daughter, was in him the whole time, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Right.
Like that evil was inside him.
Yeah. I always, and this is one of the great things about Bob as a villain, I think, or, you know, as kind of a villain, I guess is the term, but, you know, this kind of just entity, to me, he always, it's kind of what you're saying. He represents just the like kind of innate evil or the propensity for evil in humankind, and he just enables it for somebody, which is what what you're just saying, which is what I love about Bob. And to think that he's just a character that happened by accident is like my favorite thing about Twin Peaks.
That is absolutely as if anybody doesn't know, in the I think first episode of the show, like
in the premiere, or the pilot.
Yeah, there's a reflection of a character. Like, you see it's a reflection of a cameraman who was Frank Silva. You can see him in like a window or something.
He's like a set designer or something like that, I think, or whatever he is. He's just a crew member.
Yeah,
and they accidentally caught him in the mirror.
Yeah, and it's in a scene where Sarah Palmer is looking off screen and like screaming at something, I think, right? I think that's what it is. And so later on, they noticed that he was in the reflection, so they ended up using him as like the entity of Bob, and that's pretty insane.
It's amazing.
Yeah. But anyway, why I'm getting into all that is because this it kind of loops back around to Laura Palmer. And it kind of made me think they were going to bring Laura Palmer back from the dead in some way. And in a way, they kind of do.
They definitely go down that road pretty far.
Yeah. I mean, so I mean, the way the show kind of gets up. So episode 17, the show actually kind of brings like several of its plots together in like this major climax.
Yeah.
And it's actually, it's a blast. It's so much fun. There's like a big showdown in the sheriff's office between Bob and in an evil orb. And it's like Frank Silva's like superimposed face in this orb that's like bouncing around everywhere. And Freddy's super fist.
which is the best thing ever.
Which is insane. I love the build up to that. Like when, you know, he has this long monologue where he's talking to James about like his destiny to punch evil in the face with his super fist that was given to him by the giant.
Yeah.
And like later, like he uses it to get to knock out some dudes in a bar fight, and he and James get sent to jail, and that allows Freddy to be present when Bob is in the jail and punches the shit out of Bob, and it's pretty great. And so they defeat evil, and Cooper gives a speech, but there's a decision that Lynch makes to keep this stunned Cooper's face overlaid above the scene as it plays out, right?
A long time.
Yeah, and I feel like it gives us our first glimpse that what we're watching may not be real, or it just may not be happening in the way we think it's happening. And you know, everything comes together. You know, like so many of the plot lines come together in there. Like the sheriff's office is there. Robert Foster and Kit, fucking Lucy shoots the evil Cooper.
Yeah,
which is insane. And Andy's there, and like you know, James and Freddy are there, and Chad, the evil cop, has been knocked out, and Bobby shows up, and the Mitchell brothers are there with the showgirls and
with the candy girls, yeah.
Yeah. And Cole and Albert and all show up, and like Diane comes back, and it's like, oh my god, so many things are happening all at once.
It reminds me a lot of the final scene in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang in the hospital. And he's like, sure, let's bring everybody back.
Yeah, and I think that's what it's going
for.
And
it's great.
I think that's what it's going for, because it starts to introduce the idea that, like, this could be a dream sequence. Like, this could all be a dream, like, or something.
Yeah.
Which is what that scene in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is. And
right. Yeah,
yeah,
that moment where we have this kind of the superimposed face of Cole, or of Cooper, like, I was so confused by it for so long. And then he in slow motion utters the phrase, "We are all living in a dream," and it's like, oh shit, just changes the whole series. And then we get more dream sequences, I guess.
It's like an extra hour and a half after that. At that point, Cooper, Cole, and Diane end up going in this like underground tunnel. I believe it's under the Great Northern. I'm pretty sure.
Right. Or they use that key at least. I don't know.
They use his key. I'm pretty sure you see James investigating that tunnel earlier in the season, which is where the humming sound from the Great Northern was coming from that Ben was investigating earlier. See, they're all kind of like connected, but in like very ancillary ways.
Right.
And so Cooper goes through this door into like this portal, and says goodbye to Diane and Cole. And what that does is it brings him back into like, it seems like it takes him back in time to a scene from Firewalk with Me. And you see, like, it's a black and white archive footage of Firewalk with Me. And it, like, repurposes that scene so effectively.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that I was in 100%. Couldn't believe I was watching that. Because in that scene, we have that moment where Laura and James are talking in the woods. And she looks off camera and just screams.
Yeah.
And we get to recontextualize it as her seeing Cooper in the woods now. Amazing. Yeah. I loved all of that. Yeah. And we just kind of watched Fire Walk with Me for 20 minutes. And it was cool. And we get the moment where Cooper kind of takes Laura by the hand and prevents her from meeting fucking Leo and John or Jacques Renault. I can't remember which one is which.
One of the Renaults, yeah.
One of the Renault brothers, yeah. And she presumably survives. We find out at the end of that sequence
it's such a weird thing. So yeah, I mean, he leads her out of that scene, and kind of it seems to prevent her death because it shows like archive footage of the pilot episode of the show, right?
Yeah.
And you know, in that show, Pete Martell finds Laura's body on the beach, but then it shows him walking past the beach and her body's not there, and he finally gets to go fishing.
Exactly.
Arc complete. And yeah, so she sort of survives, but it's also a weird thing because, you know, in that sequence, like, he's leading her out of the woods and then, you know, suddenly she disappears and she's not near him anymore. And you just hear her scream.
Yeah. She doesn't get to leave. She doesn't get to make it out of the woods, apparently. I don't know.
And it's just so, it's so insane and bizarre. And, you know, then it, I think at that point it cuts to Julie Cruz, singing, the song, one of the songs from the original series. And then, and then episode 18 starts, and episode 18, is almost like this alternate universe where it's like, it's Cooper and Diane at first. And they decide to cross into this, this, like they talk about crossing into this area, and but they know that when they cross, things will be different. And when they do that, and they have sex in a hotel room. But then when they wake up, Diane is gone. And she leaves him a note, and it's addressed to somebody named Richard. And she's, her name is Linda. And Cooper seems different in this world, right? He seems more like an amalgamation of like original Cooper and Doppel Cooper, right?
Yeah,
like, kind of a combination of those two characters. And you know, he is looking for Laura Palmer. Like he, like Laura Palmer is somehow alive. He knows it somehow. He's looking for her and he finds her, and he goes to her house and like sees her, and it's Cheryl Lee. But she's not answering to Laura Palmer. I think her name is Carrie Page.
Yeah.
And yeah, so he's talking to her and he's like, are you Laura Palmer? And she's like, I don't know anybody by that name. But he's so determined because Cooper is such a force of good. You know, he wants to do right. He wants to do right by Laura Palmer. That's all his arc has ever been, is in this entire show, from day one. And, you know, this version of Laura Palmer, this Carrie Page, has just apparently murdered her boyfriend and needs to get out. so she takes his off. She takes him up on his offer to get out of the state, to Twin Peaks. And they go to, the Palmer house, her childhood home. And they get there and he is expecting to see Sarah Palmer there, but she's not. And, you know, it's this woman there and she's saying like, we don't know what Sarah Palmer there. And, she says a name and I'm blanking on what the name is right now, but it is a significant name in Twin Peaks lore. Do you remember in Twin Peaks, I think it's season two, early in season two, there's an old woman who Donna sees.
That she delivers the Meals on Wheels to?
Yes. And then the next day she goes back to her house and that woman is gone. And she's never been there before. Or, like, she doesn't exist, something like that. That woman's also in Firewalk with Me. Shalmont, I think, is the name, something like that.
It's something weird like that, yeah.
Apparently the woman who owned the house before this woman is the name is Shalmont or whatever it was.
Whatever the name is. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's significant somehow. I have no idea how, but, you know, she mentions that she has never seen, like, heard of Sarah Palmer, Laura Palmer. And, you know, Cooper just kind of politely says, all right, thank you. And then he and Laura / Carrie leave and are in the street, and Cooper just kind of like starts hyperventilating and he's looking around. And he just asks, like, what year is this? And at that point, like, once he asked that, I was like, what?
Yeah.
And then, like, Laura Palmer / Carrie, like, whatever.
Cheryl Lee.
Like, whatever her, like, she is somehow connected to Laura Palmer. She has to be because, you know, whatever images or memories of being Laura Palmer just start flooding back, and that trauma comes back, and she lets out that scream, and you hear that whooshing sound, and all the lights in the Palmer house go out, and that's the end of the show.
And just smash cut to credits. Well, fade to black, I guess. Yeah.
Fade to black, and then it shows, like the credits overlaying a scene in the red room of Laura Palmer whispering into Cooper's ear. And like, I was catatonic after this ended. The thing about that episode is, like, a lot of it is just Cooper and Cheryl Lee driving, like, in the dark. And it's mundane and it's, you know, a little frustrating because you're like, what is happening? Like, I don't understand this. And you have to stick with it because that ending is just so, it's bizarre. And you need to unpack it somehow. And I don't know if there's anything to unpack. Like, it's...
I don't know. My reaction, like I said, 17, I loved the end of that. I loved the, this is all a dream. Cooper's changing the series, literally, where Laura's going to be alive or whatever is happening, it's happening. And then the whole meandering, the literal drive to get to that moment at the end of 18 took me out of it so much at the time. I, you know, like right when I finished it, I was just like, Really? That was my first reaction to that moment, which sucks because it totally undercut my reaction to Cooper saying, "What year is this?" Right. Where I was like, "Oh my god, like what the f-? Oh, all right.
It's over now." Yeah.
Yeah, okay, it's over. Yeah. Yeah. Which is the most Lynch thing ever and it's the most Twin Peaks thing ever and I think my love of this show and this season will probably come out in talking it, because just hearing you describe that and like us having to just deal with this together, I already am of a higher opinion of that finale than I was when I finished it alone by myself. And I think it's going to be a thing I'm going to have to re-experience and maybe use as a future discussion sometime in a million years when I watch it again.
Yeah. I mean, as the finale was going on, like I genuinely thought Cooper was somehow saving Laura Palmer, because I always... I feel like Lynch is playing on that expectation. I think everybody expected that as it was happening. Because I think Lynch is playing on that expectation because we know Cooper is good. Like, Cooper is this force of good.
Yeah, capital G, good.
And I think Lynch knows that, and he knows that Cooper is this force of good, but the world that Lynch has created is bad. Like, it is a bad world. I think it's this kind of defeatist but also sort of hopeful ending where it's like the world will constantly destroy you and it will eat you alive, but you have to keep pursuing the goodness and like doing the right thing, and like that's like I feel like that's such a Lynch thing to do, and it's I feel like to an extent I think Cooper did somehow save Laura Palmer, but from dying at least, or from dying in that universe and living in this other one or whatever, but that may be what he did, but it's never that simple, and you can't undo the trauma that she's already experienced at that point.
Yeah, and it's interesting to think about too, right? If Carrie Page is an alternate version or something, if you want to use that phrase of Laura Palmer is such a tragic character, right? Like when you see as the original seasons, the first two seasons go on, we learn about this incomprehensible, sordid past that Laura Palmer has in drug deals and being a prostitute at One-Eyed Jack's and like an underage prostitute at One-Eyed Jack's and being raped by her father. And especially in Fire Walk With Me, we get that bold and in our face.
Yep.
And all these crazy things. And if Cooper is able to save her in some fashion or whatever is happening there, even alternate her, Carrie Page, is destined to be part of these evil things pursued by Bob across all timelines in some way, where we see the dead body just hanging out in her living room, and we don't even reference it. We don't even look at it.
Yeah, it's not even acknowledged. Yeah.
Yeah. But it still ends in this way where Cooper and Laura, Carrie Page, whatever, are together, right? He might be able to finally have an effect now that he's there and she's alive and they're together in this moment.
That's true.
So it's despondent in the most Lynch way, but also maybe uplifting a little bit. I don't know.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and there's a lot of interpretations for how this ending could go down. Like what we talked about could be totally wrong. And I don't think there is like a quote unquote right answer. But this one is interesting. Like I've seen some people say that the ending is Cooper and Laura Palmer exiting the TV show and entering the real world in a certain sense.
Like that's just the person that lives in that house in the real world.
It actually is.
That's funny.
That's part of
I love David Lynch.
That is the actual person who owns the Palmer house.
Wow.
In that scene when she answers the door. That is actually that person. But also
it's all coming together.
Yeah.
Now.
But even more than that, I mean, on the drive to that house, they stop at a gas station. The gas station is a Valero gas station, which is a real brand of gas station. And Twin Peaks, to my knowledge, has never included any real brandings or anything, any real brands, or at least it's very rare that it does.
I don't remember it if it has ever. Yeah. Nothing as explicit as that Valero station was.
Yeah, and so that is also possibly a clue into that as well. So who knows? And basically this whole thing could just be a nightmare that Cheryl Lee, Carrie Page is remembering in that moment where she sees the Palmer house and it all like triggers back to her. Like who knows? You know, there's a lot to take in. With that ending,
we need to find out if Carrie Page is Cheryl Lee's legal name. If Cheryl Lee is just her, which I'm sure it is just her like actress stage name or whatever. Yeah. We need to find out, because that will be insane.
That would be bonkers, yeah. Yeah, but there's a lot more of the show to talk about than just that finale. But that finale is a doozy, though. Like, it is...
Yeah.
I think a lot of people feel... Some people feel like it made the entire show worthless. Other people thought it was the most incredible thing they've ever seen. I'm in the latter half. So there's a lot of stuff there. A lot of people jumped off the show when it was clear that it would be the Dougie Jones hour.
Dougie Jones 15 hours.
And I think I think everyone was a little frustrated that the show was spending so much time keeping Coop as Dougie. So the way the show plays it, if you haven't watched the show, although if you haven't at this point, why are you still listening to this podcast?
Why are you 2 hours into this podcast?
The show is spending so much time keeping Coop as Dougie, and the way that happened is that, you know, the original series ended with Coop getting trapped in the Black Lodge.
Right.
And the doppelganger Coop exited the Black Lodge, the evil version of Coop that was infected by Bob. And this show picks up 25 years later. Coop is still in the Black Lodge, and this doppelganger version of Coop has been just roaming the countryside being evil. It's basically what it is. And during episodes 1 and 2 of this new season, Cooper finally escapes the Black Lodge in some of the most insane TV you've ever seen in your entire life.
Mm-hmm.
And then episode 3, I believe... Cooper comes back to the real world, replacing this tulpa called Dougie. And the concept of a tulpa is introduced later on in the show, as this kind of, it's a real thing. I mean, it's not, tulpas aren't real, but like, it's a real concept, of like this kind of body that exists that is not real. It's this corporeal entity, that doesn't actually exist. And, this tulpa that the evil Coop created called Dougie was created, to keep him from returning to the Black Lodge when Coop came back. And so when Coop comes back, he ends up replacing Dougie and not the evil Cooper. So the evil Cooper is still on the loose. And so when he does that, Cooper is basically catatonic for the, for a long time. And you know, he's basically brain dead. And I think he gets into a lot of shenanigans and hijinks. I think, a lot of people, I think people were on board with it at first. You know, people were like, okay, he'll be Dougie for like an episode or two, and then he'll be back to good old Cooper. And that was not the case, you know.
Yep. And I felt a lot like Dougie is again, it's again Lynch. Like, I know I keep saying like he kind of is giving a middle finger to the audience in some way. And I don't mean it in a mean way. I felt like Dougie was the Lynch's critique of what the audience's expectation of Cooper was. He is really bumbly and kind of silly. His only character motivation is coffee, which is, you know, in itself a joke used a lot of times.
Yeah.
He still solves and prevents a lot of crimes that are going on around him.
Despite being able to say like 2 words at a time. Yeah.
He's just repeating back whatever someone has said to him, which is an interesting, parallel to the dude in the jail with all the weird people at the very end. He just repeats whatever he hears,
right?
Which I don't know what that is, what that dude was, which is a whole other write a whole paper on that guy. But it just felt a lot like kind of Lynch expressing the dumbing down of, or critiquing the dumbing down of protagonists for TV, even though we're kind of in peak TV right now. But it just felt like there was something more going on than just Dougie and whatever that was.
Yeah.
I will say, which of course there is.
Yeah. I mean, I will say I grew to love Dougie pretty quickly. I was a big fan of Dougie Jones. And I think part of what makes that character so effective for me is that, he succeeds in everything he does. You know, this is a version of Dougie. Like, it's implied early on that Dougie, before Cooper became Dougie, was not the best guy. Like, the first time he becomes Dougie, he's like in the middle of he's hanging out with a prostitute. And you know, he was losing money in gambling debt and all that stuff, bad to his family and all that. And when Cooper becomes Dougie, it's so weird. Cause when you like, he succeeds in everything and like just by doing like the bare minimum or like repeating back whatever people do or like kind of fumbling into these situations. And it's kind of this like blissful ignorance almost that he has.
Yeah.
And that's in such stark contrast to the hyper competent Cooper that we know,
right,
who fails at everything, by the end of the show. Right.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's part of what Lynch is saying is like, Cooper's life is a lot happier just being Dougie.
Yeah.
You know?
That's true.
Even though, like, he has, like, this new moral, like, he has that moral compass of Cooper and that hyper-competence that we love so much. Like, you know, every, like, his life is so hard and so much more frustrating and so much, like, you know, it's having to deal with these incomprehensible evils on a daily basis.
Yeah.
And with Dougie, like, you know, he's got a loving wife and a kid, and, you know, he's
by the end. Yeah.
But yeah. And, you know, by he's making a lot of money with the Mitchum brothers and all that stuff. And he's like lucking into all these amazing things. And it's like, I feel like if Cooper had just stayed as Dougie, like a lot of stuff could have been avoided.
On the show. Yeah.
But I did grow to love Dougie pretty fast. And the fact that we spend so much time with Dougie, I think, makes it so damn satisfying when Cooper actually does return in part 16.
Oh my God. Yes. And he sits the fuck up and was just like arms in the air. Like, yes.
Yeah.
Like, thank God.
And that version of Cooper only appears pretty briefly on this show, like in episode 16 and 17, basically. But McLaughlin just does not miss a beat. He is back.
Cooper. He's in it as Cooper. Yeah. Yeah,
and it's incredible. Like, as soon as, like, he like sits up, he looks and he sees a vision of Mike in the red room, and he's like, and Mike is like, "You are awake," and McLaughlin's just like, 100%. I screamed. I literally screamed. Yeah. I was like, "Yes, here we go."
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's insane. So
and he still has the good in him to send Dougie home.
Yes. That's like, if you're looking for closure from most of the storylines in the series, there will not be it. But you will get closure on Dougie Jones.
Dougie Jones, yep.
And you'll get closure on one other plot line, which is Ed and Norma, which I appreciated a lot.
I really did appreciate that, actually. Yeah.
That was really nice. I really loved that. Ed and Norma finally get together, man. It's just, it had to happen. It was nice. We should talk about Audrey.
Sure.
Because she does not appear in the show until, I think, part 12. And at that point, you know, she hadn't appeared, and everybody was like, man, you know, Audrey hasn't appeared in a long time. There's going to be, like, this huge reveal where Audrey steps into the Cooper, case. She'll be, like, an FBI agent or something. It'll be crazy. And then she's introduced in, like, a pretty unassuming way. Like, she's just in the middle of an argument with this guy. And, you know, like, Audrey was once, like, a major character on the show. Like, she was the, like top four characters on Twin Peaks almost, like, I would say.
Yeah.
And she basically spends three episodes in this, like, circular argument with the short, ugly guy who seems to be her husband.
Yeah.
But they kind of refer to, like, this contract that they have. So it's like maybe like this weird, like, sort, like, arrangement that they have, like, whatever. I'm not really sure what's going on with that. And they spend like three episodes arguing together. And then they finally show up at the Roadhouse in part 16, which is what they're arguing about the entire three episodes that they're arguing,
right,
like going to the Roadhouse. They finally show up at the Roadhouse in part 16, and this is right after Eddie Vedder's song. The MC halts everything, halts the music, and says it's time for Audrey's dance. And the room clears.
That
music starts playing. She starts to do her iconic dance from the original show with that music, and then a fight breaks out. Audrey starts to freak, and there's this, like, quick cut to a panicked Audrey looking in a mirror in an all-white room. And then
she says, wait, what, I think? Or she says what? She said something. I don't remember exactly.
Something like what? And then it cuts to credits, and that's the last time we see her. That's the last time we see Audrey. And, like, fuck. Like, oh, my God. I mean, the last time we saw her in season two, she was in the middle of an explosion at a bank, you know, and
I forgot about that. Holy shit.
So season two ends on a pretty major cliffhanger for Audrey.
Right.
And, you know, my thoughts are about this whole season with Audrey is that she is still in a coma from that explosion. You know,
it's kind of
established earlier on in the season that Pete Martell, it's mentioned in conversation that Pete Martell, because he was there at the explosion too, he jumped in front of Audrey to save her, and he died in the blast. And it's not really revealed what happened to Audrey at that point. I think it's like episode 8 or 9 they talk about that. Episode 7 or 9.
Don't even remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so Pete Martell dies in the explosion. Audrey, it's kind of left to, like, she hasn't appeared yet. We don't know what happened to her. And that's part of what the show does. It never tells you, it just kind of reveals things very gradually. Throughout, like, it like very casually reveals that Bobby and Shelley had a kid together, you know, like after we had already been introduced to the kid as Shelley's daughter, like, we didn't know that it was Bobby's until like episode, like several episodes later. And so my thoughts are that Audrey, is in a coma and unable to wake, which would explain why she seemed unable to go outside in her arguments with her husband, I think.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And that evil Cooper probably raped her while she was in a coma.
And that's her son. That's why her son is the way he is.
That's where, yeah, and that's where Richard Horne came from. And he is the most evil little shit.
He is known truly.
He's like he was as bad as Joffrey Baratheon in Game of Thrones. Like I feel like that, he was the next Joffrey. Except Joffrey, at least like that actor seemed like he was a little kid and he seemed like he was having fun. This is more like a Ramsay Bolton.
I don't know that actor's name that's playing Richard Horne or whatever his name is.
Aemon Farron, I think his name is.
Yeah, fucking incredible. Terrifying. Like, just a sight of pure terror.
Yeah.
Whenever he was on screen.
Yeah, the scene where he's terrorizing Audrey's mom and Audrey's brother.
Just the most fucking David Lynch thing of all time.
Yeah, where Audrey's brother's toy just keeps, like, repeating the same phrase over and over again.
Yeah.
I forget.
Hi, Johnny, how are you today?
Yeah, something like that. Just over and over again. That's in the background the entire time. Oh, man.
yeah. That's the most David Lynch. A lot of the show is... that's not the right word. As you said, it does have some of the best sound engineering and design and all this stuff, but it has so much of this just repetitive, unsettling, like that one we're talking about isn't industrial, but so much other stuff of it is just this terrifying, monotonous droning that is going on as we're watching the most vile, mind-blowing things happening. Which is just pure David Lynch. Yeah. Like all of his other stuff also has that in it.
Yeah, and you have that a lot with this character, with Richard Horne. I mean, I think it's the first time you see him, he runs over a kid in his car.
Yeah. Right? I think we see him in the roadhouse, somebody.
Yeah, or like assault somebody at least. Yeah.
Yeah,
the second time we see him, he runs over a kid in his car. And that was horrifying, too.
Poor Harry Dean Stanton.
Yeah, he had to watch that.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's so much like just scenes that stick out to me in my mind. There's a scene where Bobby and Shelley are in the diner, and then a gunshot rings out and Bobby has to go look for it. By the way, the fact that Bobby's a police officer now, awesome.
Amazing.
I'm so all about that. That's such a huge turn for that character. You know, he was into drugs and he murdered a guy in Firewalk with Me. And like, you know, the fact that he can like turn his life around and be a police officer and be, like make his dad proud. Like that's just really nice.
But he's one of the Brookhouse boys by the end, I think.
Yeah, exactly. So that was pretty.
There's cool. That scene. Yeah, which we don't get that. We don't get that explicitly, but we have Hawk, Andy, Bobby Briggs, and Truman's brother. You know, Major Briggs' son and Truman's brother. As you know, kind of reuniting this Brookhouse boys thing, which yes. I fucking love.
Yeah, I love that. But I was talking about the scene in the diner where the gunshot rings out. Bobby goes out to investigate. And some kid in a car just got a gun and shot it, like picked up a gun from the bottom of the car. And then it causes, like, a traffic jam. And the woman...
Holy shit.
The woman... You just hear this car horn honking nonstop
the whole time.
Throughout this entire scene, right? And, like, Bobby's trying to talk to the people in this car, but you just hear this car horn honking, like, nonstop. And then Bobby finally goes over there and he's like, "Ma'am, can you please stop honking your car horn?" And it's this woman just starts screaming and shouting and it's like, "Everybody has places to go! Why are we stopping? Everybody..." And, like, next to her, there's this, like, maybe, like, 15... like, this teenager who's just... like looking like he's about to die and puking, and he looks like a zombie. Like he's just he looks a lot like actually the character at the jail at the end. That is repeating things over and over again. I don't think it's the same character though.
No. Oh, it fucking might be at this point. Who knows?
Yeah. The woman's just like, we have places to be. Why are we not? And Bobby's just kind of backing away slowly. Like, I don't know what to do with this. But it's just such a non sequitur scene. And it doesn't really, it doesn't, I don't know where it went. Like I feel like part of the idea behind the season was to show you how poisoned and corrupt the town of Twin Peaks has become.
Yeah.
You know, like how much evil has corrupted this like small town. So like characters like Richard Horne can exist. People in the roadhouse are like freaking out about things. Like characters are dying left and right. Becky's husband, Amanda Seyfried's husband, is another like evil shit. Who's like cheating on her. And then I think it's implied that he kills her. At the end when he's
killed himself,
he does kill himself. But I think in that conversation, they refer to they say something along the lines of she's dead.
Maybe. I might have missed
or
that.
If she was shot or something. And I would have to rewatch it to like confirm that, but I feel like it's implied that he might have killed her. And that's why he was like in that freaking, that freak out mode.
In that panic, yeah. Yeah,
in that panic. In which case, like, that's really upsetting. Like, Becky's a character I only know for like 3 or 4 episodes, basically, but she was Bobby and Shelley's daughter, and I love those characters, and I'll be really, and there's nothing after that scene to tell you about what happened to her daughter or anything. And there's not even anything, I think, with Shelley or Bobby at that point after that, so, except for Bobby showing up at the police station at the end, and so I feel like there's so much to unpack from that scene, and I will never know what happens.
Yeah, so much of this show is just fucking inscrutable and unknowable. Just so much of this show. Electricity is a thing that's important, apparently.
Yeah.
So is a weird.
Every episode begins with an electricity sound effect.
Yeah, there's a
Rosa logo.
I was watching with subtitles on my laptop, and just I wanted to screenshot that because it would always start with just electricity crackling. was the first subtitle, and I just want to screenshot it and be like, this is Twin Peaks the Return in a nutshell, the first second of every episode. And there's just that sequence about in episode 8. I feel like it's 3 hours or however long we've been talking about
I've got a few more points to get through and then we can wrap up, I think.
We won't need to go into detail about this, the end of episode 8, but it's I don't remember exactly what it is, but we fade to black in the first half, at the end of the first half hour-ish or so. We fade back to just a weird black and white image, and then the subtitle, New Mexico 1948 or whatever it is.
1948, right? Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Whatever it is, yeah. And we're just in Twin Peaks, we're in David Lynch land for the next 45 minutes. And it changed what I think TV can do. I think it's going to be that influential.
Yeah, that was really an incredible episode of TV. I mean, that was just a long form experimental David Lynch short about the birth of the atomic bomb. But also, it informs kind of the creation of Bob and the creation of Sarah Palmer and Laura Palmer. And I feel like there's so much still to unpack. I mean, Sarah Palmer, what the fuck is going on with Sarah Palmer ripping her face off and biting a dude in the neck?
You know what I think about actually now? We talk about this. So we have that moment with Bob. We see the creation of Bob comes out of the nuke of some sort. And then we also see the giant and another woman who I don't remember, that I don't know if we've ever seen before, I think.
I don't think we had, yeah. It's
And they kind of create Laura Palmer, it seems.
Yes. And it seemed like the bug that goes into the girl at the end. Like the couple at the end were probably Leland and Sarah, right? I would guess.
Oh, I didn't even think of that. Where I was just going is we see the orb, right? That is Bob, the black orb, and we see this kind of orange orb that is Laura, which makes me think of Carrie Page is just being that manifestation of Laura, right? We see Bob is able to jump bodies, and they're both just different color orbs. Laura may just be this kind of antithesis to Bob. This kind of perpetual cat and mouse game between the two of these entities that seem to be created in these same moments.
Yeah, maybe that's kind of what Bob and that's kind of what Mike was for, right? That was kind of the idea behind him in the original series, the one-armed man.
Maybe. You know, I don't even know.
Which I was just kind of surfing through Twin Peaks' Wikipedia page earlier, one bit about the original series that I hadn't even thought, I hadn't even dawned on me. But Bob and Mike were kind of meant to represent the two kind of opposing dualities. But there's another pair of characters in the original series named Bob and Mike, Bobby Briggs and Mike Nelson.
Wow. Yeah.
And that's almost parallel of those characters in the high school setting. And it's holy shit. That's so layered. I had no idea. But I mean, there's so much more in the scene. I mean, one of the most heartbreaking things throughout the season, Catherine E. Colson's phone calls with the log lady, which we referenced a little bit. I mean, you could, we said before, you can tell how close she is to death while filming. She died a few weeks later.
I feel like she died as soon as they announced the show was starting to film. And I was like, oh man, there's not going to be any log lady. This is crazy.
Yeah.
And they must have filmed all of that at once. And it's used in the most heartbreaking, effective way.
Yeah, and yeah, it all culminates in that final call where she's calling Hawk to tell her that she is dying. And she gives this, like, incredibly, like, poignant speech that is just so powerful to watch, but it's so perfectly in keeping with that character. She says, like, my log is turning gold at some point.
Yeah.
It's just really, it's really beautiful. And it's, like, it really feels like David Lynch just, like, saying goodbye to his friends.
Yeah.
And it's kind of amazing to watch. And even at the end of the episode, like, every episode that included a dead actor, like, at least for the first time, will say, like, in memory of this person. Like, and she shows up in episode one, so it says in memory of Catherine Coulson in that one. But in episode, I think, 15, when the Log Lady dies, it actually says in memory of Margaret Langerman, who is the character name of the Log Lady.
Is the character's name?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that shot of just the lights fading out on the cabin that she's in, like... Yeah. Just fucking damn it.
Yeah.
God damn it, David Lynch.
Waterworks, man.
Yeah.
But there's just so many great moments from so many great actors. Like, it seems just yesterday we were talking Michael Cera as Wally Brando. we were but children back then, Mike. That was, like, episode 4.
Yeah. That was a pre-episode 8 world, Mike.
Yeah, exactly. And then also, like, Tim Roth and Jennifer Jason Leigh as some assassins working for Evil Cooper. J.R. Ferguson from Mad Men, who played Stan on Mad Men. He's an FBI agent in the show with the most over-the-top line readings I've ever heard, and it's the best. He's the first time you see him, he answers a call from Cole, and he's talking to a subordinate, Wilson, and Wilson's like, well, how are we going to find him? And he just slams his phone down, and he's like, Wilson, how many times do I have to tell you?
What we do here at the FBI, and like, that's it. We just cut away.
Slamming on the table. It's great. And yeah, Amanda Seyfried as Shelley and Bobby's daughter, Becky, I think is great. And also has one of the best, like, I feel like Lynch shots where she, it's when she's first, I think the first episode she's introduced, she jumps into the car with her husband and she snorts a bunch of coke and she just, like, brings her head up and you see like an overhead shot of her just, like, staring into the sky and that high kind of overtaking her. And it's very similar to stuff that you used to see with Laura Palmer. And it kind of feels like, you know, history repeating itself in that way. And that's partially why I feel like she died at the end of the show.
So
it definitely felt like it was implied, but, and other stuff. I mean, I also want to give a shout out to, Candy from the Mitchum Brothers, segment of, cause she was amazing.
She's got one of my favorite comedy bits in the whole show, in the whole season.
Where she smacks the fly. And
with the remote, yeah. Just whiffs him across the face. Like, absolutely amazing.
So good, so good. And, I mean, Tom Sizemore is in this show.
Yeah, like... yeah. And he's awesome.
Yeah, he's great. You know, this
Ashley
so
Judd's awesome.
Ashley
Monica
Judd.
Bellucci's awesome.
Monica Bellucci shows up in a dream sequence.
Yeah, a very important dream sequence.
As herself, by the way, which is great.
I was, so when Cole, there's that scene when Cole's like, I had another Monica Bellucci dream.
Yeah.
And I was like, did he just say that? And then we cut to the dream. And it's like, oh, there's just Monica Bellucci.
It's Monica Bellucci. I'm convinced David Lynch wanted to do the season of TV just so he could have lunch with Monica Bellucci. I believe that's
Yeah, I would believe it, yeah.
I feel like we barely mentioned Laura Dern, but Laura Dern's incredible on the show as well as the as this version of Diane, who turns out to be a Tulpa throughout the show, and then as the good version of Diane towards the end. You know, she's great. Naomi Watts is as Janie E is phenomenal. I think like some of her best work since Mulholland Drive, probably. It's so much good stuff throughout the season. Like, there's like Brett Gelman shows up and like so many people.
I had a favorite story arc that I can't remember the character's name in like episode five when or four, when Dougie goes to the meeting, you know, the team meeting at his insurance thing, and the guy has to drink the green tea latte.
Yes.
But I think, honestly, I made a joke about Jerry Horn earlier, but he's got also some of my favorite comedy bits.
Yes.
Where he's afraid of his foot stuck on the ground.
Yes.
And he's like trying to touch it. His plot feels like it's going nowhere until he gets to watch one of the climaxes through his binoculars backwards.
Yes, I love that, because that was my favorite bit, because he's watching it through his binoculars backwards and he's like trying to understand why he can't see. And then he's also like blaming himself for the fact that Richard Horn just got electrocuted by lightning and like exploded.
Yeah. Yeah. He starts smashing his binoculars while saying bad binoculars. Yeah. Really weird.
Yeah. It was insane.
He somehow made it all the way to Wyoming. My favorite. Great. Amazing.
Yeah, it's so good. So good. I feel like we can wrap this up, Mike. This is a season of TV. that will stay in my mind for a really long time. And I can't wait to just one day set aside like a whole day and just watch all 18 hours in one sitting like a hermit.
Jesus Christ. I'm in. Let me know.
It'll be amazing. So,
and we'll live record our 18 hour episode.
18 hour commentary.
Yes.
We will be very sore by the end. Like, our voices will be very sore. It'll be terrible.
Worth it.
It'll be awesome. All right, Mike, where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog. And if you like Dungeons & Dragons, my friends and I post our games at youtube.com/geonerd79.
And you can find me online at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog. All my podcasts and stuff at filmbook.com. And check out crookedmarquee.com for some of my work there. Just posted an article about 310 to Yuma for its 10th anniversary, and it's pretty cool. Go check it out. Thank you for listening to Film Bookcast, all 2 hours of it. I'm Mike Smith. That is Mike's Crecio. If you're listening to this review via our podcast on iTunes, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, take a moment to give us a review. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, and even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you're emailing about in the title of your email, because we produce just so many different ones, it's hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Now join us for the next episode of Film Bookcast in 2 weeks, where I guess we'll be reviewing Mother. I think that's the plan, Mike. Either it or Mother. I think Mother will be the one to, like, I
think so too.
Like,
yeah.
I'll definitely talk about it because I saw it, and I'll talk about it in my discussions. But Mother is definitely the one I'm really excited about. So definitely, and it's new Aronofsky, man. How could I pass that up? Aronofsky doing pure horror, which that's exciting. That's
really, I'm scared just thinking about that.
Yeah, that's really exciting. So looking forward to that, and then you can check out our next complete works, where we're talking Nicolas Cage's role in 2006's The Ant Bully. So that's exciting. I was looking it up. There's a huge cast for that movie. Also from the director of Jimmy Neutron, Boy Genius.
Wow.
That's pretty wild. I do like Jimmy Neutron. So we'll see how that goes. So thanks so much for listening, guys. We are out. Thank you.